Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Mr. Justin Kaufman, you heard him on the morning show today and the same thing tomorrow. So this is John Hansen filling in until 10 o'clock, and I'll keep you occupied here for the next 3 hours. Love for you to join the conversation as well, 312-981-7200. Wanted to say good evening to Don Kleppen. Don, I was excited to see you walk into the building here this evening.
Good evening, John. Yeah, it was nice to see you too. Pleasant surprise.
It's never, I gotta say, I give so much credit to you news folks. Obviously, you just starting out your day. But man, the folks, Kim Gordon in the afternoon, man, it is a tough time to stay up with everything, the twists and turns on our political stage nationally, and of course the local news too. Every afternoon, Don, I take a nap, an hour nap. I work on CW26 at the Jam in the morning. It's really early, so I take a nap. And I just know that I'm going to wake up to about 14 news notifications.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like, why even watch it early in the morning? You know the story's going to change by the time you get to the afternoon.
Yeah, it's a fair point. There is a ton going on, just everybody, and we're all plugged in all the time, so it's just the updates are kind of constant. And yeah, there's a lot of twists and turns, and you can just kind of follow along now, which is fun, too.
And you were just talking about the teacher strike. October 17th, the date set for that strike?
Yep, that's what they say. If they can't reach a deal before, you know, between now and then.
Right, which of course is the million-dollar question. We had a strike possibly, what was it, 2016, I want to say?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Right to the wire, and it was actually at the wire. I think it was right around midnight when they decided not to. Of course, a lot of folks remembering the 2012 strike, which lasted for a long time. It'll be interesting to see. You know, public opinion, of course, rides this thing just a little bit, even though both parties would like to say it doesn't. Obviously, Mayor Lightfoot has kind of put her foot down, I guess, in some regards in terms of wanting to see exactly what the teachers want. CTU issuing that strike notification today for October 17th. Better have an expert break it all down. Heather Cerrone's going to join us in the 8 o'clock hour to talk about the latest. She's actually filing right now for the dailyline.net. And, Don, I don't know if you've been following or, you know, the story out of California, the idea of getting these college athletes to the potential to get paid.
Oh, yeah.
Through endorsement deals. Well, now that's coming here to Illinois, potentially.
Right.
State Representative Chris Welch is going to be joining us. He's the one kind of leading this effort. I'm curious what you think, Don. You know, you never know, because this is a real divisive issue amongst sports fans.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a pro college athlete getting paid or no?
You know, I got to be honest. I haven't thought about it too deeply, but, you know, just these, I know the California new legislation on Monday, and then the Congressman Welch coming right in afterwards. Like, it's made me think a little more about it, I guess. I mean, at the end of the day, the NCAA makes billions of dollars.
Yes.
I mean, almost as much as like the NFL.
I heard
like $14 billion or something. And the students make nothing. And they're the ones, I mean, not only are they putting their bodies on the line like professional athletes, but they got to go to school. They got to pass with a degree. It's a lot to ask.
Yeah, certainly a scholarship is great. Don't get me wrong. It's worth a ton of money. But a lot of these athletes come from backgrounds where they don't have a ton of money to begin with. And then they have to pay for books. They have to pay for, and then they have no time to get another job.
Right.
And they're just talking about endorsement deals as of right now in California. I don't know if that's exactly what Chris Welch is proposing here, but we're going to chat with him at 7:30 to talk all the way through it. And then I've got a rapping OBGYN coming in, which I know will make your eyes perk up a little bit. What is that exactly? Her name is Dr. Wendy. We're going to talk about Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And she came on the Jam this morning and she rapped an OBGYN breast cancer awareness rap. And I said, what better thing to get people interested in the topic, or at least, you know, one thing to make you pay attention a little bit more. So she's going to come on a little later, and then we're going to talk about the Black Sox scandal, which, of course, 100 years. That World Series was being played 100 years ago right now.
Wow.
And I know a little bit about it, just from Eight Men Out and from Field of Dreams.
Totally.
And I've, like, built up this myth in my mind of what happened. But it's one of those stories that, like, I think a lot of people know about, but maybe don't know all the details.
Yeah, exactly. And you just maybe feel the shame.
Right.
I'm still not sure of what exactly happened.
I actually asked Pete. I'm like, we're okay to talk about that. I mean, it's been 100 years, and we love our White Sox now, and they would never do anything like that. And I think a World Series return is more imminent than people realize, and a lot to look forward to for the White Sox, of course.
Heck yeah.
But, like, we can still talk about that. That's 100 years. Not too soon on the Black Sox scandal. We'll get to all that in just a little bit. And, Peter, we good to go? Because I wanted to talk, first off the bat, the story of the day. Well, one of the stories of the day that really kind of moved me. I was talking with Rowan Anna about it. The sentencing for Amber Geiger, sentenced to 10 years, which in and of itself is a story. The sentence in its, you know, she was obviously charged with murder, found guilty of murder. If you're unfamiliar with the story, just a quick recap. She was off duty as a police officer, just coming off of her shift. She was going back to her apartment complex, which was, had some people had said was kind of confusing. One of those complexes where every floor looks the same if you're not really paying that much attention. She wasn't. She walked into the door and sitting there in a couch just eating some ice cream was a gentleman named Jean. I always say Jean. It's Jean was his last name. And she shot him twice. She said she felt threatened. The jury didn't go along with that. They had an opportunity to give her kind of a lesser charge under the Castle Doctrine, the idea that if she felt like she maybe perhaps was threatened, they didn't go with that. Anyway, she was found guilty, I believe it was yesterday, it might have been 2 days ago, but the sentencing hearing today was emotional. The gentleman's brother took the stand and chatted and offered forgiveness, and she ended up being sentenced for 10 years. But it is that testimony of the brother. I'm hoping we could play a little bit of it and then maybe chat on the back end about the level of forgiveness. So here is Brant Jean testifying during the sentencing phase about what happened to his brother and his murder. Amber Geiger.
If you truly are sorry, I know I can speak for myself. I forgive you. And I know if you go to God and ask him, he will forgive you. And I don't think anyone could say it. Again, I'm speaking for myself, not even bad for my family. But I love you just like anyone else. And I'm not gonna say I hope you rot and die just like my brother did, but I personally want the best for you. And I wasn't gonna ever say this in front of my family or anyone, but I don't even want you to go to jail. I want the best for you. Because I know that's exactly what both of them would want you to do. And the best would be give your life to Christ. I'm not gonna say anything else. I think giving your life to Christ would be the best thing that both of them would want you to do. Again, I love you as a person. And I don't wish anything bad on you. I don't know if this is possible, but can I give her a hug, please?
And then he asks again, and then he actually goes down and gives her a hug that lasts for about a minute or two. Emotional. I could see the judge was wiping tears out of her eyes. I was doing the same thing.
Just can't imagine. I mean, to witness such an act like that is so forgiving.
Yeah, and just to have it in your soul to do that. I mean, he mentions religion a few times. I'm not the most terribly religious person, and maybe that's why I don't know if I could find that sort of forgiveness. I know it's taught, and I would love to think that in that position you feel that way.
Right.
I think that there obviously is something to be said, and I think I do believe her in the respect that I feel like she didn't enter that apartment with the intent to kill him. She was startled, and I think that she was confused by her own mistakes. And that she should be punished. But I also don't believe that she was cold-heartedly going out there in search of murdering this young man. So I could see where, you know, this is different than someone who premeditated and murdered your sibling. So maybe that there's your avenue to find sympathy.
Right.
But oh my gosh, what a moment. And I hate to try and make too big of a thing out of it because it's a real micro thing. It's between these two people. But man, a lot of people have said at the 10-year sentence, Gosh, that's a hard one, really, to dive into. 312-981-7200 if you've got any thoughts about the sentence. Or really, like, could you forgive someone? Could you find it within yourself to stand in front of that person? Not only in... say the words, and he kind of even hesitated and said, I didn't want to say this in front of my family, but I hope you don't go to jail. I mean, I don't think that this was coordinated, rehearsed. I think that this was in the moment. And, you know, maybe you think something differently before you're going to go sit on that stand. And then you sit there, you've gone through the whole testimony. I imagine he was there throughout the whole trial. I don't know for sure, but I, you know, he obviously knows all the details. But then you look at another human across from you, and really these victims' statements or these victims' family statements, I mean, this was a jury decision for the sentencing. It wasn't a judge decision, although Roe was mentioning it, there might be some flexibility after the fact. But, I mean, these victim statements are probably so powerful to a jury, right? Like, if I'm a jury, that's who I'm looking to.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's what this is all about, right? I mean, I know it's supposed to be justice against the state, but, I mean, for the state... but you got to look at the family, right?
Yeah, it's always, I think from a jury perspective, it's the human to human connection. I mean, nothing that, no evidence that's like data or anything they're going to show you is as powerful as like somebody's testimony or like what they're feeling.
Right. So when he's giving that, there must be some sense of this could change how long this woman's going to go to prison for. And, you know, I don't know what his family and him talked about beforehand. When they were sobbing, there was a woman. We didn't play the audio because it's just a long embrace, but there is a, you can hear a woman sobbing. And I read later that it was his mother was really overwhelmed. I mean, I imagine that if you're a mother in this case, you're grieving over your one son, and she says she lives it every day. Of course, how could you not? Pride in your other son for showing that compassion. What an emotional moment. And so 312-981-7200, I don't know if you could find forgiveness in your heart or any thoughts on the sentence. I find this dangerous territory for me to talk about. I think a lot of people don't understand the context of the situation, how many dozens and dozens of unarmed black men have been shot by police officers that are white. I think that's an undeniable fact that has happened, and some have gotten away with it, probably unduly so. But in that lens, you can't always use that lens to determine a sentencing for someone for a completely different situation. So I know that's really tough. So 10 years, I don't know. For whatever reason, that felt kind of right to me. I don't know. Some forgiveness there. I don't know. But 312-917-8200, love to hear your thoughts. So we're going to chat about that in just a little bit and then dive into the teacher strike and some other things. It's John Hanson in for Justin Kaufman on Extension 720 here on WGN. Extension 720, John Hanson in for Justin Kaufman until 10 o'clock this evening, talking about the Botham Jean case and Amber Geiger getting sentenced to 10 years and the emotional day in the courthouse in which Botham's brother forgave Geiger and hugged her at one point and didn't wish her any ill will, I think he said, and wanted her not to go to jail, said he wasn't speaking for his family. Just an incredibly emotional moment. We played it earlier, but if you can go watch it, just Google it. You'll find it anywhere. And it's powerful stuff. Just asking 312-981-7200. First of all, if you think 10 years is fair, but also, could you forgive? Could you find that inside you to forgive the killer of your brother, even if it wasn't necessarily in cold blood? But obviously she was in the wrong there. Let's go to Chris. Chris, you're in Chicago. Welcome to WGN.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I have tears in my eyes as well because I have a different view than I've ever had before that you could forgive like that. Because I don't think I could forgive like that. I am going to put his message on my phone so that I hear it all the time. And I'm just sorry. I'm just so happy that somebody would have that kind of grace.
Yeah, because, you know, he could have easily gone up there and said, throw the book at her. Prosecutors wanted 28 years, sort of symbolic, one for every year of life that that the victim was. And he had to know that that was going to influence jurors and maybe what they would end up deciding. And Chris, I agree with you. I just found myself so shocked, awed. I don't know. And we've heard forgiveness statements in the past, but in that moment where you know that your words are going to impact her life, her time behind jail, it's incredible.
The courage that he had to give her the hug and the genuineness of him, I have never heard before in my life.
Yeah, and I don't. I just feel like if nothing else, because obviously this case, when it first caused protests, of course, of people, you know, upset about what had happened, of course, an off-duty police officer killing an unarmed black man in his own apartment, eating ice cream, doing nothing wrong. I'm not saying that this hug will calm, because there's going to be a lot of people upset about this 10-year sentence. And we're going to have a lot of these issues to dive into and discuss. And there's going to be other shootings and there's going to be other times we all need to come together. But and I hate to extrapolate, but man, it just gives you, I don't know, faith in humanity? Am I going too far, Chris?
No, because I think that the biggest thing that we should take from this is the brother. Like, he was the closest to him, and to have that kind of grace and forgiveness, this is what we need in our life right now.
Amen to that. Chris, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well put by Chris. Yeah, putting it on your phone as a reminder. Yeah, I hope, you know, in this news cycle, boy, we forget things quick. And this story will be gone from our psyche in, well, I don't know, what, 48 hours will be moved on, especially with what's happening on the national political scene. Yeah, it'd be great to kind of remember this moment if you were moved by it. I had a couple texts on the text line following up with some extra questions. 630 chimed in, if this officer would have been on duty and shot Mr. Jean, she would have been giving a much longer sentence. Yeah, I think that if, I don't know what scenario she was on duty going back home or what the case may be, but you say that she would have been given a much longer sentence, but that we haven't seen that all the time. And, you know, it may be the exact same circumstances. And another person chimed in that they didn't go for manslaughter. They went with murder because of the fact that he wasn't attacking her. She says she felt threatened, but all evidence points to the fact that he was not rushing her. He was sitting there having ice cream in his own home. And look, she made a ton of mistakes. And they went in today in the sentencing trial. They played a lot of the text messages. And look, she doesn't have a perfect past. It's not like she's never had a racist thought. In fact, she's had some and she's expressed them. And it's not like on her Pinterest board, there was quotes about firing and taking one shot. And she's definitely an imperfect person, to say the least. And she made a horrific mistake. And some of it might be rooted in some subconscious feelings of the other race. I don't know. I don't want to dive too much into that. But yeah, gosh, just the ability for him to just get up there and say it. One thought, this is from the 630, if she was holding a gun and he was just eating ice cream, why didn't she say get out? Then maybe he could have explained he lived there. Not sure if they talked or not. Yeah, I don't know the nuts and bolts of what went on inside that room. I know that she fired pretty quickly. And they kept on saying there were so many warning signs that it was not her apartment. Either she had a doormat or didn't, but either way, the scenario was where she was walking into his apartment, it was the opposite. It was either a doormat and there shouldn't have been one, or there was and there wasn't. The furniture was set up completely differently. And I think it was on the wrong floor. I mean, I think that she went up and there was distracted text messages that she was sending back and forth with another police officer. And some of it was like some scandalous language. You know, none of that particular thing matters to me. She was completely in the wrong, made a gigantic mistake, and had some sort of, I don't know if it's malice or just, she's also a police officer whose instinct, I mean, you would expect those people, even if they're off duty, to be the most well-trained to handle a situation. If it was an intruder in their house, they're not taught to immediately fire upon them. They're immediately taught to either get out or defuse the situation in some other way than just firing. So her police training certainly didn't come in handy in that situation. Either way, the emotional statement of his brother was incredible. 630 says the judge can give her less. 10 is the jury recommendation. Yeah, and the judge, obviously, for good behavior, she could get out in 7 years. Boy, that seems not enough. I don't know. It's so hard to find that line. But for me, I didn't have the reaction of that she should spend every single day of her life, or even the 28 years. Gosh, that seems like a long time. But to his family, maybe not. Certainly not his brother. But 708 says maybe this brother saw the genuine remorse during her trial. Yeah, I think so. I think he probably sat there. And I watched a little of the testimony back and forth, and she wasn't great on the stand, but she certainly had what seemed genuine emotions. I mean, how can you not? Unless she really was filled with hate inside of her heart, whether it's for black people or whatever the case may be, how could you not have a strong emotion? And I think it went beyond, oh, I'm just in trouble. I think it was genuinely a horrible feeling. 847 chimes in with, most experts say you don't forgive someone for them. You forgive someone for yourself. You can't carry around that hatred and anger forever. It'll just eat at you. So although the brother was wonderful to make that pronouncement in public, he probably didn't forgive her to make her feel better. He forgave her so he could go through his days in peace. Yeah.
That's ticky-tack, I think. That's the whole argument against expressing gratitude to people, is that it's really a circular sort of thing.
Or maybe that's where you find the words. Maybe that's where you find the strength to say it, and then forgiveness can come after that. You know what I mean? Step one.
Exactly, and that's part of the process.
Right, because if he's just doing it for himself, that didn't feel like it in that moment. It genuinely didn't. I can't get in his mind. 773 asked, was she inebriated in any way? And I apologize, I don't have the exact answer. I'm going to try and look during the news break. I don't think so. I think she was just coming off duty. She was distracted through text messages that she was sending with an officer she was having a relationship with. And other people testified that they had walked into wrong apartment complexes in this place before. Again, I'm not making an excuse, but there were some circumstances that, but it doesn't matter. The moment you get to that door, you feel like you would know. Anyways, fascinating discussion. Quick break here on 720 WGN. Wednesday evening, everyone. Extension 720. John Hansen in for Justin Kaufman till 10 o'clock this evening. Kind of a dark and dreary, foggy night in Chicago. I took a walk before I came in tonight. I kind of liked it just for one night. The cloud, the mist.
It's perfect for October.
I felt like it was in a mystery novel. It was pretty cool. But I hope the sun comes back. I think it will tomorrow. Don will have the forecast again. I wasn't listening when you just said it, Don.
That's okay.
I'll wait 25 more minutes till I get that.
You'll get it again.
Hey, out in California, they've just passed and signed a law that will allow college athletes to be able to earn endorsement money starting in 2023. And here in Illinois, there is a similar push, and it's led by Illinois State Representative Emmanuel Chris Welch, and he joins us on the line. He's from the 7th District. Representative Welch, how you doing today?
John, I'm good. Good. I'm glad to be out of that cold and rainy weather.
Yeah, I think we all are. Hey, before we go into the story, I got to say, the 7th District I know pretty well. I'm from Downers Grove originally, which is west of the 7th, but I spend a lot of time in the 7th on my Eisenhower Expressway, just plowing on through that traffic. You're right there where it gets heavy.
Well, you know, we're famous for the Hillside Strangler.
Yes, yes.
So you've definitely spent some time in the 7th District.
Yes, I think everyone out there has. Get off on one of the exits. Visit some of your fine establishments. Hey, Chris, let's talk. Is it okay if I call you Chris? You go by Chris?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's talk about this because, first and foremost, I'm saying I'm in huge favor of this. I love the idea of paying college athletes. I think that NCAA officials, coaches, everyone makes a ton of money. It's about time the athletes should, too. Obviously, you feel the same way. Our listeners may not. 312-981-7200. Join this conversation. But, Chris, walk us through this bill, how it would work, and who's exactly going to get paid, potentially.
Well, it's identical, John, to the California bill that you talked about when you opened up this segment. I did that intentionally because that bill was signed into law by Governor Newsom on Monday of this week in California. And so it's now the law in California. And we know that the NCAA will probably test that bill. And so, you know, that court challenge could have implications on what we do here because it is exactly the same language. And basically what we're saying here is that this is about fairness and equity. This is about allowing student athletes to profit off their own name, their own likenesses, and their own images. The colleges and universities and coaches have been making millions off of these kids for years, and the NCAA has been making billions. We're talking about just doing something that's the right thing to do and letting them profit off their own names, their own likenesses and identities. And the examples I've been given is everyone remembers the great Final Four run by the Loyola Ramblers.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in downtown Chicago. You saw those kids' likenesses everywhere.
Yeah.
The university did quite well. Coach Porter Moser did quite well. He got a multi-year, multi-million-dollar deal. But the kids didn't get anything.
I was playing PlayStation and playing NCAA football, and you can't tell me that they weren't replicating the exact same name and look of players, even though they just had the number on the back. You knew who they were, and we knew who they were, and that's wrong.
Absolutely. And now you're talking about Ed O'Bannon and the guy who started all of this, John. You know, he sued the NCAA and he won. And the EEA Sports was very much a part of that. And using these folks as likenesses, it's pretty clear who they are. You're just not sometimes using their names, but everything is a match. And they're making millions off of these games and using these players. But the only people not making the money, the student athletes.
And so we should make a clear distinction. You're not suggesting that athletes get paid necessarily like a wage for the hours that they put in, regardless of the sport. You're talking about deals specific to them in the form of endorsements.
That is a great question, John, and that is absolutely an important distinction to make. We are not talking about salaries. That's an entirely different bill. That's an entirely different debate. We're talking about allowing these student athletes to sign endorsement deals, hire an agent, sign endorsement deals that they can profit off their own likeness, name, and image. And the bill is very tightly written, and I think it was artfully crafted in California because it doesn't cost a university a dime. It doesn't cost the NCAA anything. It just allows them to profit off their own name, likeness, and image. And the law even says if a deal contradicts a contract or goes against a contract with the college or university, that contract would be void. And the example I've been given there is Northwestern, my alma mater, has a contract with Under Armour. A player can't then go out and get an endorsement deal with Nike. And so the law would contemplate those types of scenarios. And so we believe that everything that the opponents could possibly bring up has been addressed in this very tightly written legislation.
Someone has already texted in. I imagine other people have the same thing. It's a valid thought. The idea being that the scholarship, some of them, obviously with the cost of college going through the roof, 4 years, that's a lot of money. Isn't that enough?
Well, that confuses the issue. And that's why I think it was important that you draw the distinction. When you hear people saying is scholarship and tuition enough, that goes to the whole salary argument. That has nothing to do with this particular issue. This is a very tight issue. It's the universities are profiting off of your name, your image, your photo, your likeness. And we're saying, why can't the individual student profit off of that? You know, I'll give you a perfect example. Louisville University, a couple years ago, a study was done. They made $45 million a year in endorsement deals off of student athletes. And of that $45 million, $400,000 went to the basketball players and scholarships. The coach, Rick Pitino at the time, was making $8 million. Mm. His assistant coaches were all making six-figure salaries. The athletic director was making $1 million plus. And the point we're making by using that example is that's what's going on in all of these big colleges and universities. The coaches and the administrators are making the money off of these student athletes, but the student athletes are making nothing.
For our, I was going to say for our college sports lovers, and we got a lot of them here in Chicago, a lot of listeners as well, who value keeping these teams and, you know, they love their team. It's all about the school name, not necessarily the player's name on the back, which, you know, you could debate back and forth. I think most of these players still have team mentality in mind, while, of course, taking care of their individual futures too. I think that a byproduct of this, perhaps, correct me if I'm wrong, but by allowing star athletes or athletes, other athletes too, that are able to get these endorsement deals, whether they're local, national, whatever the case, some of them might stay in college later. Some of the reasons they go so early to the pros is because it's time to earn that money when they can, and who can blame them? If you love college sports, this might enhance the product.
John, I wish I can take you with me to Springfield and help me argue this bill, because that's exactly one of the points I've been making. You know, a lot of these kids leave school early because they want to jump for the money. You will actually lengthen a student's length of time in college. They may actually complete their degree because they know that they can legally, without jeopardizing their eligibility, make money out of their own endorsement deals. But look at Zion Williams out of Duke. I mean, of course, he's a talent that's unbelievable, but he jumped for the money. He probably would still be in school if this was the law of the land.
I'm asking you to do this. You don't have to if you don't want to. And I'm trying to do the same thing because I'm on your side and I'm blatant in that. And someone please join the conversation. We're getting a lot of texts. Call on in 312-981-7200 if you disagree. I just can't put myself in the mindset of someone who's against this and why they care. I don't get, have you heard objections that you have, you know, you deem as, you know, that makes sense? Or are you with me that I just don't know why people care if people make money?
The NCAA has come out in opposition to this, of course. Their argument is the same as it was in California, and that's that it blurs the line between amateur and professional. And I say the NCAA blurred that line a long time ago when they turned it into a multi-billion dollar industry. You know, they have TV contracts that these colleges and universities rake in millions off of every year. The coaches make millions every year. And they do that because they put those student athletes on the court or on the football field, on the baseball diamond, and they make money off of them. Everyone's profiting off of these athletes except the athletes themselves.
And I don't know if you've watched a football game lately. It's not the most safe sport out there. You're risking life and limb in the other sports too. They're risking future earnings by being out there and playing for free.
Well, go back to Louisville. Let's look and see what happened last year in the tournament where the kid got hurt, superstar athlete got hurt, such a bad injury. He didn't even return with a scholarship this year.
Right.
They're done with him. And if this was the law, you know, he probably could have at least brought some revenue in and put some money in the bank through endorsement deals. But now he's lucky if he can finish college.
Part of the reason I imagine why you designed this in the exact same as the California bill, and you kind of touched on this, is that this California bill is going to get challenged. Who knows how it's going to ride through the courts? And I imagine you wrote it the same so that if this eventually does survive court challenges, by producing the exact same bill, you're mitigating the risk of this going through another court challenge by being a separate, different law.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Very strategic in what we did here. I mean, it's identical, including the effective date, with the intention to allow time for a legal challenge. And, you know, that's the hope. With California now being the law there, they can run this thing in the court any day.
Right.
But I got to tell you, I think the NCAA is going to fold and recognize that this is the right thing to do. Congress has even taken this issue up. Representative Mark Walker out of North Carolina filed a similar bill that is being debated in Congress right now. And so this could be the law in all 50 states by the end of the year if this thing makes it out of Congress. So the reason that that's happening is because it's the right thing to do. And people all across this country are saying it's the right thing to do. And let these kids cash in on their own names like this is an identity.
Representative Welch, I didn't ask you beforehand, so feel free to say no, and I can tackle it after the commercial break. We do have a phone call about an interesting question. Do you mind if I take it and maybe you could provide an answer? Totally free to say no if you don't want to.
I love radio. Let's do it.
All right, just making sure. All right, Tim. Tim's not in the 7th. You're out in Naperville, a little west of Representative Welch. Tim, you've got a point you want to bring up.
Hey, you know, the paying the athletes extra money kind of leaves a weird taste in my mouth, considering that their education is paid for. What about, like, a 401k trust fund or, like, a health savings account that can accrue over time so when these guys retire and they might have injuries and all that, it can make some money for them later on in life?
So, Chris, Representative Welch, the idea of maybe not giving the cash money for the endorsements, but setting it up, I don't know if that's more complicated and if maybe we shouldn't tell people how to spend their own money. Your thoughts on that one?
First, I want to continue to draw the distinction. The universities aren't giving these students anything. These are people who are being reached out to by companies and offering them endorsement deals based on their success, their names, their likenesses, and their identities. The universities aren't giving them anything. So to compare this to scholarships, that's just incorrect, and we have to correct that every time.
Well, the college is giving them free education, but they're not giving them extra cash, is what you're suggesting.
They're not paying for visits back home and regular everyday living that college students go through. I know several athletes because I was a college athlete at Northwestern back in the day, and there's several broke athletes out there just struggling to make it. Yeah, tuition's paid for, but there's other things that kids like to do when they're in college.
And also, you're traveling and you're practicing all the time. You can't have another job. Tim, it's an interesting point. I guess my question, and I agree. I think it took me a little while to get to the point I am now, because I think that for so long there's been this severe distinction between amateur and professional. And yeah, maybe it does leave an interesting taste in your mouth. Although, Tim, I got to say, it's a good idea. I feel like we should teach every young person, whether they're an athlete or not, to put it all in a 401k, Tim.
Yeah, I think it's good for the country, it's good for business, it's good for them, but I do feel like, these guys are young, and what are they going to do? If they start getting big dollars while they're in college, some of these guys, when they get that kind of money, they ruin their lives.
Yeah,
and they might not make it to the pros, and they could have all kinds of other problems. They're still kids.
Yeah.
They're still 19,
Yeah, that's a fair point.
I think that argument applies to a lot of the actual pro athletes.
And
let's not ignore the fact that we need to teach these students how to manage their money, period. And that's whether they're student athletes collecting revenue from endorsement deals, or these pro athletes who jump into college and 5 years after they leave the pro game, they're broke. That's a whole other issue.
Yeah, Tim,
we have to teach them how to manage their money.
Tim, we appreciate the phone call. Thanks for chiming in. 312-981-7200. Yeah, thanks, Tim. 312-981-7200 if you've gotten any other thoughts on this one. Yeah, I got to say, I love the idea of helping people, young people of any skill, ability through athletics to help them learn how to save. Because on my first day of college, I signed up for a credit card to get a T-shirt. So, and I didn't play any sports. I wasn't going to be able to cover that. Representative Welch, it's a fascinating discussion. Where do you go from here? Because this one doesn't take an effect in the law till California till 2023. Where are we at in the session? Are you still just building support for co-sponsors? What do you think of the timing of this?
So I think we need to move at warp speed, John. California is now the law in California. And if I'm a coach in California, that is an amazing recruiting tool. I think we need to level the playing field, get our coaches here in Illinois, and get these Big Ten coaches here in Illinois and all these big conferences on the same playing field. Because if I'm a coach in California, I'm using it as a recruiting tool. And when I was at Northwestern, I got to tell you, we had a lot of people on my team who were from California. But if we don't have that as an option, that's a problem. So I'm pushing hard, hoping that we can get this thing called in veto session at the end of this month. So yes, I'm spending these few weeks here trying to build support. Every day we're gaining more co-sponsors. I'm happy to see newspapers coming out in strong support for this initiative. Guys like you, John, getting out here and having this discussion is important, because it helps us get to where we want to go at the end of the month.
Well, you don't say it, but I say they should get paid for their time, too, and every athlete, whether you play badminton or basketball. But that's just me. We'll focus on the first issue first. And Representative Welch, thanks for your time. And I got to say, I hadn't even thought about the recruiting aspect of things.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Big. California's got a big head start right now, but we can catch up.
Well, forget your Wildcats, or our Wildcats here on WGN. I wish them success. But, man, if we can get Illinois 4 wins, I'd be happy about that. Representative Welch, thanks for joining me here today.
My pleasure, John. You guys have a great evening.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick commercial break. We got some callers in. 312-981-7200. Should college athletes in Illinois, across the country, whatever you want to do, be able to earn money for endorsement deals specific to them, meaning their likeness, their name, the success that they've had? Or you can go further and wonder and weigh in on the other thing, too. Coming up on Extension 720. Justin Kaufman off tonight. You heard him this morning with Jisuke on the morning show and for Steve Cochran, and he'll be back at it again tomorrow morning, I believe Friday as well. So I'm sitting here until 10 o'clock talking about college athletes and the bill that Representative Welch got. I thank him for coming on and chatting through it and taking a call there, too. Let's take another one. Let's go to Rich. Rich, you're in Bolingbrook. Athletes, paid or not paid?
Oh, they should definitely get paid. I know somebody brought up earlier, they're getting a scholarship. They're getting a free education, so that's like pay. But there are other people that get scholarships. Some get it based on academics. Some get it based on their socioeconomic background. And no offense to those scholarships, but those people are not helping generate literally millions, if not billions of dollars for the university system and the NCAA.
That's a good point.
And the other thing is, if you're there on an academic scholarship, I don't think, unless you have a bad incident in the chemistry lab, that there's a chance by going to classes you're going to sustain an injury that could knock you out of your future career.
Yeah, that's a real good point, and also someone that's there on an academic scholarship, I know they probably got a lot of classwork to do, but they probably have the time to get a job and earn.
Right. Plus, no offense to the professional athletes, but for the guys that do wash out and don't make the pros, there's a good chance that they're probably not going to make as much money down the road as the person that did go there on an academic scholarship.
Right. Rich, did you pull over on the Stevenson and you're calling us from the shoulder? It sounds like things are zooming by you.
Oh no, I didn't pull over. I've got hands free though.
Perfect.
So.
Perfect. All right, Rich, thanks so much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
All right, we've got another minute or so. Let's go to Randy. Randy, you played college basketball.
I did.
What's your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm kind of astonished by it. I have been for a number of years. I realize the money has gotten bigger, but I was able to go to college because I got a scholarship. I didn't own a suit or a sports jacket where I went. My family couldn't have afforded it. I played at a national championship team. I got my degree. I went on and got my master's, worked on a doctorate, and I've never been anything but grateful. And if they're using my likeness, so be it. You know, I really think the minor league baseball system or the, you know, NBA, the Major League Baseball has the system. If you don't want to go to college and you want to skip that step, go to the minor leagues, the G League, and take that route. But if you want to go to college, it's an amateur sport, and I just don't see what the uproar is about athletes being paid. The money is bigger than when I played, and I think probably you could increase the stipend,
right,
the dollars that for the students, but I have to tell you, I'm grateful for the education I got paid for.
Well, Randy,
for
I got to ask. I mean, I think it's awesome. You're grateful. I think that that fills your soul with joy, and you've obviously had a successful run after that. I guess what I'm saying is, even though you're grateful, why should you, and this is not meant in a mean way, why should your gratefulness stop someone else from earning? I mean, maybe you believe that they should just be grateful, but just because you're grateful doesn't necessarily mean that they should have to just be filled with as much gratefulness. Does that make any sense, what I'm trying to ask?
Not really.
Okay.
I got my tuition and room and board paid for. I got to travel the entire country. I got treated better than most of the other students on campus. I certainly ate better. And the lessons learned and what I learned in terms of sports and discipline has served me well in the rest of my life. But primarily, I got my degree. Only 0.006% of all college athletes will go on to the pros.
Yeah.
So, you know.
But isn't that an argument for that they could? But isn't that an argument that they should be able to earn a little money on their success if they're not going to go to the pros and make money while they can?
No, it's a scout. You got a scholarship.
Yeah.
You got your education paid for. That's why I really could understand having a larger stipend per diem.
Okay.
Given the money the NCAA is generating with the tournament, things like that. But the reason I'm grateful is I got to go to college.
Yeah. Hey, Randy,
and get a degree.
I don't mean to cut you off. I really appreciate the point, and it's a great argument, and it's great to hear someone that went through it as well. Randy, thank you so much for the phone call. Quick break here on Extension 720. Well, this kind of matches the mood of the evening. A misty, cloudy night here in Chicago. Rain, of course, too, as well. John Hanson in on Extension 720, in for Justin Kaufman. Thanks so much for joining us here. 303 East Wacker, 18 stories above our beautiful Chicago River and Wacker Drive. Just to put a real quick bow on the college athletic story that we were talking about, Randy, I just want to let Randy know, if you're still listening, I wasn't trying to be rude. We really had to get going. It was a great call, though. And just to show how split people are on this, the 269 chimes in, I agree with this caller 110%. And then the 630 says, Randy's missing the point. The school's giving the athletes free room, tuition, and for playing for them. Why should it prevent an athlete from profiting from their name and likeness instead of someone else? The money wouldn't come from the school. It would come from the business that benefit from the athlete's likeness. Certainly a hot-button topic. It doesn't get any hotter-button topics than the Chicago teacher strike. And I tell you, people, we already had Heather Sharon ready to come on. And Heather, they broke the news just for us, right in time.
They did. Wasn't that really nice of them to work with our schedule, John?
Yeah, it was wonderful. Heather Sharon of thedailyline.net, the best coverage you're going to get of Chicago politics, county politics, and state politics. I love you, Heather. Talk us through what happened tonight.
Well, the Chicago Teachers Union had a meeting of their House of Delegates, and as I understand it, they unanimously voted to strike on October 17th if there is not a deal with Mayor Lori Lightfoot's Board of Education by then. But there's a twist. There's always a twist.
Yes.
Right, John?
Yes.
So two other labor organizations have also notified the city that they plan to strike unless they get a new deal with the city. And those two organizations have also agreed to to go out on strike on October 17th as well.
Uh-oh.
And they are doing this as part of a coordinated action. So if one group gets a deal, great, but all three have to get a deal, or they say they're not going back to work on October 17th.
A union of unions.
Correct. And so it's about 36,000 city employees. And here's what that means, is that if the teachers union goes out on strike on October 17th, which is a distinct possibility, parents won't be able to take their kids to Chicago Park District locations and have a strike camp. Now, way back in the 1980s, when I was in elementary school,
yes,
students, they went on strike, and my parents, who of course worked, dropped me off at Loyola Park, and I sat there all day until the teachers figured out an agreement. But that won't be possible, it doesn't seem like, this time around. Now, Mayor Lori Lightfoot and CPS CEO Dr. Janice Jackson have released a contingency plan. Yeah, parents can go online to the CPS website and see that. Basically, school buildings will be open with non-union staff, but it's going to be a tense couple of weeks now in Chicago.
Just take the kids to the Jewels. Let them sit there, wander the aisles a little bit, buy some soup. I don't know. I make light of it, but boy, this is a serious one. And Heather, I wonder, and I imagine this is part of the decision-making process, if obviously what they're going for, the unions, is the strength in numbers and kind of putting the shoe down and saying, look, you guys are in tough shape if this all happens and if we all don't come together and get deals for all of us. I wonder what effect that's going to have on public opinion, which doesn't necessarily, I don't know, does it play a huge role in the decision-making process of what goes forward, what the reaction is of a John Q voter?
I think it does. I mean, I think, we had a strike here in Chicago in 2012. There was a one-day strike in 2016 of the teachers. And I think Chicago sort of knows how to handle that. Like, it's a blizzard. Like, nobody enjoys it. But we all know, you know, what dibs is and what to do and what shoes to wear. But I think it would be, I'll have to do some more reporting on that. But I think it would be pretty much unprecedented for the Park District staff as well as the teachers to be on strike at the same time, and would really sort of grind the normal gears of a normal workday to halt.
Yeah, and I imagine, see, that's where it gets complex, because if there is a strike, or if there's even, we're getting real close, I think generally people love to support teachers for the most part. I think that people are behind it. I think what is working against the teachers in this sense, and this is just my feeling for things, and I'm not going to ask you to speculate on that, Heather, but more just offer some context, is that they're being offered what I think a lot of people would consider a fair raise. And I think with that on the table and so open and out there, that I don't know how long that good sentiment lasts, given that other people are striking with them and could really grind this thing to a halt.
Well, that's really a big part of this. Now, the mayor has offered teachers an average of 16% raise over the 5-year term of the deal. And the teachers basically have said, okay, well, that's great. Appreciate that. But our biggest concern is staffing in the schools. And here's another twist. Teachers aren't allowed to strike over staffing issues. State law requires that strikes be focused on economic issues. So the teachers have a very difficult argument to make. They have to basically keep parents and residents on board and saying, look, I know that they're giving us, you know, a fine pay raise, and they haven't really objected one way or another to it, but our biggest concern is that our schools aren't properly staffed. And even though the mayor has promised to hire literally hundreds of new nurses and social workers and librarians, we just don't trust her to keep those promises unless they're in our contract. So that's really the crux of the teacher's argument. They're saying, you know, we're not so much worried about our pay or our benefits, but the schools have really been cut deeply to the bone over the last several years. You and I talked, you know, back in the day at DNA Info about how the school district was sort of teetering on the brink of bankruptcy for a while, and that those cuts were tough, and the union is really pushing Mayor Lori Lightfoot to make up those cuts now that the district is on firmer financial footing.
Yeah, Heather, I guess my question is, and look, I agree in many senses that our schools are depleted in terms of resources, nursing, librarian staff, all this sort of stuff, and it's important, don't get me wrong. But if the teachers aren't able to use that in strike language, then what are they going to counter with to kind of counter the offer from CTU? From CPS?
Well, they can just basically declare it non-acceptable, and that all opens up the possibility that the city and the school district could ask a judge to basically declare the strike illegal. Now, back in 2012, when a lot of these same issues were on the table, Mayor Rahm Emanuel actually asked a judge to declare that strike illegal because it wasn't over core economic issues as required by state law. A judge declined, and about a day later, Rahm Emanuel settled the strike and everybody was back in class. So we're not really in uncharted territory. It's certainly sort of, you know, well-trodden territory, but it's a more complicated argument than saying teachers want more money and the city doesn't want to give it to them. The teachers are really saying, look, you know, we have dealt with years of austerity. We can't do it anymore. Our kids can't do it anymore. Our parents can't do it anymore. And we need the mayor, and their hashtag for their campaign is put it in writing. And that's really what it comes down to, which is really an existential question of how the school district should be run and how promises should be enforced over staffing.
Yeah, but the put it in writing thing, like I don't think there's a Chicagoan out there that isn't aware that, oh, the city ain't doing too well economically. I think that $838 million deficit number has been projected onto us very often by the current administration. It's well known that the city has deficits it needs to make up, and the whole state does. So I guess what I'm asking is that, I mean, to codify that you must staff this amount of people, I mean, that is almost a harder financial hardship for people than for the city than raises are. So I think, I mean, it's going to be a tough road to not only convince the city that they need to do that. First of all, they may not even be able to strike legally on that. But that's a hard argument to make in the public, given the current economic situation, isn't it?
It is. It's a little bit apples and oranges because the school district has a separate budget from the city. So certainly the city does face an $838 million budget deficit. And there's a possibility that the deal would require Lori Lightfoot to basically have the city give more money to the school district mm-hmm. so that they can make this contract. But the important thing that I think the teachers would want me to remind you of is that the school district is roughly getting $1 billion more over the next 2 years, thanks to a change in the way that Illinois funds its schools, passed into law actually by former Governor Bruce Rauner. So the schools' budgets are in better shape, and they're saying we've got to put that money in the classroom, and we need enforceable promises to make sure that that happens, because they've been burned in the past. They spent 8 years at loggerheads with Rahm Emanuel, and certainly Mayor Lori Lightfoot's first couple months in office has been the same.
All right, I'm looking at my calendar here. We're on a Wednesday. It's the 2nd. I'm looking 2 weeks and a day ahead to Thursday, October 17th. That would be the strike day. Walk us through between now and then what we're looking at timing-wise in terms of how this negotiation proceeds.
Well, I think that we're now in a new phase of it. It's unclear as to how, you know, whether the pace of negotiations will pick up. But I'm sure you remember this from 2016 when they averted a strike. Then they went right up to midnight. You know, we had we were told 11:45. Okay, we think there's a deal. Stand by. So it went very late into the night. And if I were a betting woman, which I am not, but if I were...
I'm a betting man, so let's play the game.
I would assume that we're not going to have a deal if we have a deal until 11:45 on October 16th. So these things tend to pick up the pace as you get toward a hard and fast deadline that we now have. Keep in mind that the teachers' contract expired in June of last year. So this has been sort of many months in the making, and the snowball is getting bigger and bigger and bigger and is about to crash down the mountain.
So this is another question that you may not be able to answer, but you can answer everything for the most part. So the 2012 climate with Mayor Rahm Emanuel, I don't know if this is the best way to describe it, but a little bit more us versus them. Mayor Emanuel had talked about closing schools. It was a little bit more contentious. Mayor Lightfoot comes in on a very progressive sort of ticket and wave, almost like she has a little bit more of the credentials of people that are more on the progressive side of things, and she won 75-25 in the runoff. Is it a tougher fight for teachers going against Lori Lightfoot than it was against Mayor Emanuel?
It's certainly a different fight. When Rahm Emanuel took office, he was determined to be the education reform mayor. You know, he was determined to require teachers to be paid based on performance, which the union hated and fought back against. He wanted a longer school day. He wanted a longer school year, and he didn't want to pay the teachers anymore. So there were very serious, sort of clear-cut, you know, one side, the other side issues during Emanuel's first 6 months in office. It's different during Lori Lightfoot's tenure now, because Lori Lightfoot will be the first to tell you she agrees with the union. There need to be more librarians. There need to be more social workers. There need to be more nurses. But her point is that those promises are appropriately placed in the school's budget that was passed earlier this year. To put them in the contract would be inappropriate and would tie the district's hands. So we reporters have heard her say several times over the last couple of days, "I'm not Rahm." And I think that that is objectively true, and also true from where she's coming into this argument. It's a strange sort of, no, I agree with you, I just don't agree with that strategy. And that's sort of where we are. And of course,
go ahead.
Let's not forget, the union did not endorse Lori Lightfoot in the mayoral election. They backed Tony Preckwinkle. And I know that they feel somewhat, you know, like they've got to sort of throw some elbows, because, mm-hmm. you know, you lose an election 75-25, people question whether you can really turn out the political muscle that they seemed to demonstrate in 2016 when they forced Rahm Emanuel into a runoff.
Yeah, and it is a catch-22. A more progressive mayor might have more credentials for it, and people might go and vote with her and say, yeah, she's got people's best minds and heart, and she should do it. At the same time, a strike... Boy, and if it comes down that she's the bad guy in this, or she's the one preventing progressive things from going through, that could really damage her sway and sort of thing. So it could go either way with this sucker.
That's right. And let's not forget that Lori Lightfoot, this is really her first rodeo, so to speak. She's, you know, never been through a public negotiation like this. She's never dealt with contract negotiations that have dragged on this long and have been this public. So she's really sort of, you know, in a new sort of experience for her, whereas the Chicago Teachers Union not only went through this in 2012 and 2016, but many of their leaders have traveled the country talking to other teachers' unions and sort of spreading what they did, which we saw sort of play out in West Virginia and Oklahoma and in Denver and in Oakland, which really sort of changed the narrative for a lot of teachers' unions across the nation. So they know how to do a strike. They know how to keep, they know how to, you know, try to get public support, and they know, you know, what's at stake, because they really felt like they were, you know, public employee unions really felt like they were on the brink of extinction when Rahm Emanuel took office.
All right. That puts a nice bow on the teachers' conversation. We're going to take a quick break, and then really quickly afterwards, Heather, we're going to go back to your old beat for a fascinating story out of, what, the 45th, right?
That's right.
Oh, I can't wait to talk about this. Coming up next on Extension 720 on WGN. Chatting about the teacher's strike potential, set the date for October 17th. And shifting gears here a little bit, Heather, to your old beat that we covered, that you covered for DNA Info, the 45th Ward. Always drama-free during elections. Set us up a little bit, because we went kind of back and forth between aldermen and razor-thin elections.
That's right. So Alderman John Arena served two terms in the 45th Ward, and then in February lost decisively to Alderman Jim Gardner, in part, at least, because he championed affordable housing developments in the 45th Ward, and as well as in the 41st Ward, which is closer to O'Hare. And that angered a lot of people who worried that he was encouraging projects that would bring an undesirable element to the neighborhoods, which are very sort of suburban in the city, if you've, you know, sort of bungalows and with yards and that type of setup. So he lost, which left him 2 years short to qualify for a city pension. So he applied for a job with the Lightfoot administration, and he started Monday as the senior advisor to Acting Planning Commissioner Maurice Cox, who will be confirmed, we expect, by the full council later this month. And the twist is that his hiring came over the vehement and vociferous objections of both Alderman Gardner and Alderman Anthony Napolitano, who represents the 41st Ward, who said that he was unfit to be a city employee based on how he conducted himself as an alderman. So we asked the mayor why she hired former Alderman Arena, and she said, basically, because I decided he was the right person and those other aldermen should focus on their own business.
Yeah, so there's no angles of is this corrupt? Is there, or is anyone crying foul on this sort of thing? I mean, it seems like this happens all the time. Politicians retire, get beaten, and then they apply for other jobs within the government using their connections. Is there any shadiness to this that the people are alleging?
There's certainly not any, sort of evidence of corruption. Alderman Arena is certainly not the first, as you said, defeated politician to find another job in the city of structure. Former 41st Ward Alderman Mary O'Connor, who was defeated by Anthony Napolitano in 2015, she also works for the planning department. So this is, I think, relatively business as usual. I think that because Alderman Arena was such a polarizing figure on the city council, I think it's a little bit more difficult for some aldermen to accept and welcome him back to the city hall break room, I guess.
How much hay have they raised, or has it just been comments to the media?
So Mayor Lightfoot said that Alderman Jim Gardner had met with her one-on-one to urge her not to hire John Arena.
Wow.
And he said he vented himself at me over this, and vented being a direct quote there. And as shown in the past, she was clearly at least somewhat offended that Jim Gardner had taken it upon himself to weigh in on her hiring decisions, and was very clear that while she welcomed all feedback, she would be the one making the final decision.
This probably doesn't surprise you out of this ward.
It does not. Alderman John Arena, he was not shy about staking out exactly what he believed in and what he wanted. For the first couple of years in his first term, he was Mayor Rahm Emanuel's biggest thorn on the city council. They later sort of, moved closer together in subsequent years. But he fought very hard for the affordable housing complex that will be built on Northwest Highway near the Jefferson Park police headquarters, actually. He really sees that as his legacy. And in the planning department, he will really be tasked with building more affordable housing throughout the city, which is really one of Lori Lightfoot's key campaign promises.
All right, I've hit the up button. The elevator has arrived. Give us the pitch for thedailyline.net.
Thedailyline.net is your one-stop shop for all things city, county, and state politics. So if you want to know what's going on at City Hall with all of the machinations and manipulations, we're the place to go. And we are a subscription news service because news costs money, but
yep,
you can try our free email out, and it comes every morning at
Say hi to the family for me, Heather. Good to chat with you. Some sleep, okay?
I will.
Never a dull moment. Quick commercial break, then the news on Extension 720. Extension 720, John Hansen in for Mr. Justin Kaufman, taking you up until 10 o'clock. All right, I met Dr. Wendy this morning, and I thought we got to bring her on WGN. She was on the Jam this morning, talking all things breast cancer awareness. That's Dr. Right. Wendy, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you, John?
Your energy is infectious.
I'm ready.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. You're a doctor. Where do you practice? What do you do?
I am. I'm an OBGYN. I practice in downtown Chicago. So I'm born and raised in Chicago, South Side in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I did my medical school training at Northwestern, my residency at Rush, and I'm just happy to be here. I practice right downtown across the street from the Art Institute. And I mean, my day-to-day is working and delivering babies and doing women's health, you know, taking care of women. But my side hustle is, you know, fun, entertaining, edutainment, we like to call it.
Edutainment, I like that. Did you always know you wanted to be a doctor?
I did, ever since I was like 5.
Really?
Before I can remember, my dad actually just recently found a model that I had when I was a child.
Really?
Yes, like it was a little model of, and I actually posted it on my Instagram, it's like all the body parts. It was called the Visible Woman instead of the Invisible Man. It was called the Visible Woman.
Okay.
And you put it all together, and she had a little pregnant belly that you could take in and out of her. And he's like, you played with this things for hours. And when I saw it, I was like, I remember this. But it's like such a vague memory.
It's a vague memory. You almost don't remember it until you see it.
I'm telling you, I was a twinkle
little baby
in my eye.
Yes.
Twinkle in
your
own
eye. Yeah. That's awesome. You are such an approachable doctor. This is the thing. When I visit the doctor, it can be, you know, for anyone out there, it's a nerve-wracking experience.
Exactly.
Whether you're just going for a physical or especially if, oh, God forbid, something's a little wrong or you don't feel quite right. But man, you are so approachable. Do your patients tell you the same thing?
They do. They often will tell me that I'm the most, the doctor that's explained the most to them in the past, the doctor, you know, compared to their docs in the past, the doctor who has just kind of made them feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I've had friends who told me I'm a little too comfortable with women's health.
Right.
I'm like, vaginas. They're like, okay.
And there we go.
We're having lunch. Right. And here we are.
And here we are. On the radio.
Broke the seal on that thing.
But we got it. I mean, then what we're going to transition to talking about is, you know, breast cancer awareness. It's important to talk openly and honestly. And who better to talk that way than with the doctor?
Exactly. If you can't be open and honest with your gynecologist, who can you be open and honest with? Like,
yeah.
You need to be able to be comfortable. And I'm comfortable. So I think that helps my patients to open up, you know, and to not feel intimidated. And then to your point, there's that fear factor. You go to the doctor. What's wrong? Is everything okay? What's wrong? Well, my approach, is, as we talked about this morning, is let's find whatever it is early so we can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the goal is to catch it, not to be afraid and avoid it. Because if you're afraid and avoid it, then you can end up in a worse situation.
Yeah, I know that you specialize in women's health, but man, there are a lot of men out there, and I'm one of them. I am as stubborn as can be. I think it's almost like an embarrassment thing that you think that you're going to go, and the longer you wait,
yes,
the more embarrassed you are, because you're thinking the doctor's just going to yell at you. But at the end of the day, you of all people, doctors are the people that don't judge.
We need to not judge.
You've seen it all.
If you have a doc who judges, you might need another doctor because, I mean, who, you know, you can't go in there and be like, I'm sorry, I didn't come in. My patients come, I haven't been to the doc in 5 years. I'm like, I'm glad you're here.
Yes.
Welcome back, you know?
Let's not weigh on the fact that you're late to the party.
No.
Let's be happy that you're here
Let's
at all.
Let's be happy that you made that leap because clearly it was a leap for you, so high five,
yeah.
You know?
Amen to that.
Mm-hmm.
Breast Cancer Awareness Month, obviously a huge month. Let's talk about some of the myths or things that you hear that you want to kind of dispel some rumors on.
So one of the things is, you know, again, you know, if I avoid it, if I don't go, get tested, then I won't have it. Well, of course, that's not true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Early detection is key. People think of breast cancer as a death sentence. They think of the word cancer as a death sentence, right? Early detected cancer, most cancers, and especially breast cancer, can be 99% treatable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the type that you would find with a mammogram or with a, you know, if you felt a really small lump and that can be removed, that treatment is almost 100% successful to save your life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's one thing. And then I've heard that, you know, all the whole gambit. Mammograms are dangerous and are harmful. Self-breast exams cause, you know, harm. The only harm really that you're running into that's significant or potential harm in doing self-breast exams is finding something that's normal that you think is abnormal, right?
Right.
So it causes some further testing or it makes you more anxious or nervous. Personally, I'd rather catch something that's okay over missing something that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I'd rather have a couple of false false calls, if that's a thing,
mm-hmm.
then not find anything at all. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's something that people are, you know, afraid of. And again, it's human nature to be afraid of the unknown.
Yeah. Mammograms, how early? I know that there's a lot of different opinions on
this. There are. Not only are there different opinions about it, there are different guidelines from like the guideline bodies, right? The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, which is my governing body as an OBGYN, says that you can start them as early as 40 and do them every year. The United States Preventative Task Force, USPSTF, all the
whatever
alphabet,
it is, yeah.
All the alphabet says start them at 50 every 2 years. So we kind of, as clinicians, can kind of split the difference, and you as a patient can really advocate for yourself, because mm-hmm. insurance companies, for the most part, are going to pay for them every year starting at age 40.
Right.
I have the personal opinion that I'd rather know. So I'd rather a person start their mammograms at 40. Now, here's the other caveat to the guidelines. They say, well, if you're at increased risk, start them at 40. If you're at lower risk, start them at 50. Well, who's not at increased risk? Because we all have pretty crappy diets. No judgment out there. But we don't necessarily eat like a full plant-based diet. Mm-mm. All of us are having some sort of processed meats, you know, or foods at some point in our lives. Many of us have a family history that we may or may not even be clear about.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us are overweight. No judgment to that either. But that's just something. These are things that are risk factors. They're risk factors.
And that's interesting. People don't consider that. I mean, they should consider it a risk factor.
But it is for breast cancer. Being overweight, not having children until later ages, which is the trend in the United States.
Right. No judgment.
That's a no
judgment.
We are judgment
free here on WGN.
These are facts alone.
Mm-hmm.
But those are risk factors. So I think that when you accumulate kind of, you know, put all of those potential risk factors together, we're all at increased risk as far as I'm concerned. And mm-hmm. it's worth at least getting screened every 2 years starting at 40, but if not every year.
We talked about on the jam this morning the idea of mammograms sometimes not covered by insurance. Yep. Most of the time they will, or if you're underinsured, or a lot of uninsured mm-hmm. listeners right now. And I just wanted to give a shout out to A Silver Lining. They're an organization here in Chicago, Dr. Sandy Goldberg, who was a breast cancer survivor herself. And I should find her number. I'll do it during the commercial break. But A Silver Lining, we run their PSAs here, too. They do incredible work. And what she does is they will find a way to get you that mammogram
Absolutely.
For free. And then they figure it out from there. I mean, they're your place to go. And there's other organizations like that,
there
too.
There are. And I think another thing to keep in mind when you are un or underinsured is that there may be a time lag. But if anything, that should make a person even more motivated to make that appointment. It might take you 6 months or 9 months to get in. But I'd rather do that than wait until like you find something, right? So then you have to almost be further on the prevention side because it might take you a little bit longer to be seen. And keep in mind, there are institutions, like I'm on staff at Northwestern, there are institutions where they will have payment plans or even payment adjustments based on your, you know,
economic status.
Your economic status. Yeah. So you can get free or very low cost health care if you ask. You have to ask.
You have to
actually call that. Yeah, call the billing department and say, hey, can we work something out in order to be able to get that screening done?
Yeah, it sounds like whether it's your own health or your own economic situation, no embarrassment of the hospital or the doctor. You need to talk to it.
Right, talk about it. Ask the questions because, you know, the what do they say? The squeaky wheel gets the grease.
That's the old adage.
But you know what I mean? And not to say that you're being upset or angry, but you do ask the questions. And a lot of times you'll be surprised.
Let's talk about men and breast cancer.
Yes.
Obviously not as frequent. The numbers for women, 1 in 8? I mean, it's shocking. Versus 2,500 cases of men.
In the year, which is significantly lower, but we just had a high profile.
Yeah.
Matthew Knowles, Beyonce Knowles' father, was recently diagnosed. And I was trying to figure out how he found out, because mm-hmm. I would believe it'd be with a self-breast exam, because obviously men aren't necessarily getting mammograms, right? Or like breast screening.
We might notice. I mean, it's harder to hide, I guess you could say.
No, but you should feel. Yeah, if anything, it actually, in theory, could be easier to feel a small lump because there's less actual breast tissue, if you will.
Right.
But yeah, that's even more of a reason to be checking once a month. Feel around. It seems weird, right? But no, like, know your body.
Right.
Know what's happening and be the first person to call and say, hey, this doesn't seem right. Let's get this evaluated.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I imagine that, look, there's a month for everything these days. There's mm-hmm. a week for everything.
There is. There's a day for everything.
And it's easy to become kind of jaded to those, but I think that they really do serve a purpose to refocus people who might have that feeling of embarrassment or whatever. So I imagine October's a big month for you.
It is. I was like so excited to be even on the jam this morning because, I mean, from a women's health standpoint, breast cancer is like, you know, top of the list. And quite honestly, there are other things that women need to be really concerned about as well, like heart disease and mm-hmm. lung disease and colon cancer. So breast cancer is not the only ailment that affects women, but it's a big one. And it's one that does draw a lot of attention. And it's one that is so preventable or able to be detected early. So again, like you said, drawing people's attention to it, reminding women, hey, this is important. This is not something that you need to ignore. You'd be better off paying attention to it periodically and telling your friends, telling your family, talking to your family, asking grandma what, that was my rap this morning, what did grandma pass away from? Do we know?
Right.
Because if we know, we can be looking more closely at those things.
How often, is family history something you're asking on the forefront on your first examination talk with people?
Every time. I ask them, and then if they say, well, yeah, grandma had something, I'm not sure, call your mom. I'm sitting right here.
Right
call
now.
Your mom or send her a text.
Right.
I'll Let's wait. Find this.
I got other patients. Yeah, you want to know, right?
And you should know. And so I always advocate for people to put the stuff in their phone. Oh, somebody told me. They told me that grandma had this. Put it in your we have
your notes,
Google
whatever it
notes,
is.
We have Excel spreadsheets. We have all kinds of stuff on our phones these days. Why not keep a list of family history? And if you know that, you know, your mom had a lump, well, how old was she? If you know granddad had a colon, you know, polyp, how old was he? Because these can all be related. You don't realize sometimes that colon cancer, ovarian cancer, breast cancer can all be genetically related.
Mm-hmm.
And that might even lead somebody to have like a breast removed,
mm-hmm,
or their ovary removed when their ovaries removed when they're done having children to prevent cancer,
mm-hmm,
you know?
What do you say to people out there right now that are maybe going through this, that they've been diagnosed, different sort of stages?
Sure.
It's a tough fight.
It is. It is a fight. And I think that the spirit that I was trying to convey, not only in my rap that I did this morning, but there's...
Oh, you're going to do it soon.
Oh,
don't
yeah, I'm excited. Mm-hmm. We have a whole song that's coming out later this month. And it's with one of my friends who's a breast cancer survivor, The Brave Chick. She's on Instagram, too. And her feeling this year, and I was totally with her, was that let's fight. Let's not lament or be sad. I mean, yes, it's not a fun thing. So, of course, you know, not to be insensitive to it. You should be, you know, feel those feelings, and that your feelings are valid if you're sad about it. But let's also motivate and get ready to fight this thing,
mm-hmm,
you know, and kind of almost make it scared of you, because your will and your power and your strength are more than, you know, than this cancer. So I think that that's the only thing, because all you can do, all you have sometimes is your will and your spirit, and just bringing that part up and reminding people that, you know, they're supported and that, you know, that you are ready to fight. I think that's the biggest thing.
We're going to take a commercial break, and then I got to find out, when were you always in? Tell you what, we'll do it. We'll do it. I've got so many questions. Quick commercial break, then more with Dr. Wendy here on 720 WGN. Extension 720, John Hansen in for Justin Kaufman until 10. If you miss Justin, and who doesn't? Well, guess what? Get up tomorrow morning at 6. He's on the morning show. He was yesterday. No, today and tomorrow, excuse me, and Friday with Jisuke, and we'll take you up till 10 o'clock. Kent Smith after me, I believe, at 10 o'clock. We'll make sure after that in a little bit. But yes, I'm here with Dr. Wendy McDonald. Long day for both of us. We're double shifting here. She was on the show that I co-host, The Jam, on CW26 this morning. So poignant and so approachable that I had to bring you in here to the WGN listeners. All right, so you are, is it OBGYN? Is
I that am. My, yeah, OBGYN, OB-GYN, OB-GYNY. Gyno is one I don't really like. I'll tell
okay.
you the truth. It sounds a little, it's not bad.
It's weird.
It's just gyno. I'll go to see the gyno. It doesn't sound right,
right.
to me. You know,
go
no
to
judgment.
The OBG, yeah.
We said that, no judgment.
Exactly. Gyno. You wrote a book.
I did.
Tell us about that.
Okay, so the name of my book is called, you're going to like this, John, It Smells Just Like Popcorn.
Okay.
Yes. So, why? What is the story behind that one? I had a patient who came and talked to me, and I've told her since about her being the inspiration for my book, and she's fine with it. I actually gave her a free copy because she said it smelled like popcorn, and I was like, what? Why mm-hmm. would it do that? And it inspired me to actually write a book. It's like a 300-page book about all the random things I can think about healthcare. Not just random stuff. Like, what are ovaries? What are breasts? What is discharge?
Things that you that people are afraid to ask.
And if you Google it, Google will tell you you're dying. So I put it...
They will, you're right.
In an indexed guide. And as you can see, I have a special type of humor. So it's to me, it's funny, it's entertaining, but it's also very educational.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was a fun thing. And I put it out 2 years ago, and I republished it this year just with some updated, you know, information about Zika and all the things that we don't talk about as often anymore.
Is Zika still prevalent?
Yes.
I was just going to ask, because I just feel yes. like that was, oh, that was so 2017, but no,
nope.
It's
still here. It's not quite as scary as it used to be in the sense that it's not in as many locations,
mm-hmm.
but the locations where it is, you should still not travel if you are expecting or planning to be expecting.
Okay, so if you are pregnant or if you any time yes. in the next X
3 months.
3 months, okay.
3 months, yes. So Zika, the CDC, I'll plug this, the Center for Disease Control has a whole map of Zika places. If you are thinking about or trying to get pregnant or you're pregnant, Google that, because your doctor will say don't go.
All right. So, Dr. Wendy, you also rap. Do you rap because you wanted to find a way to present this information? Have you always rapped before you were a doctor?
Great question. You know, I've always sang. I've always rapped. I've always... I'm the karaoke enthusiast of the room.
Oh,
you
what's
know?
Your go-to song?
Oh, I will Waterfalls, TLC, Stomp
God.
It.
That's
yes.
a good one.
And I will do the whole rap, like for real. Like
yeah, you don't
left
just
eye,
you
no.
don't just do the singing part.
Oh
you
no,
dive
left
the
eye,
whole.
And I have conjured her, you know, spirit in my soul, and so I get down. And so, but then I also, when I was a kid, this is so weird. I used to rewrite like commercials in my head, like oh, this commercial should say this, or this you know TV show should say that, this like intro or whatever. So then I randomly started remaking. Or parodying, if that's a word. Is that a word?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, let's make it one. Parodying songs and making them about healthcare topics, because the information does need to get out there, but people don't necessarily always want to hear you just say it or talk about it or write about it. They may want to hear it in a catchy tune that they're like, wait a minute, did she just say a vagina? She did.
Yeah. Do you rap to your patients like when they come in the door?
I don't.
You
I
get
don't.
The charts out. You're like, give
the
us
most
your
I've
weight.
Ever done is like sang a happy birthday song while I was delivering a baby, like doing a C-section. That's so sweet.
Oh, really?
Like, happy birthday to the baby while we're delivering. I did that, like, on request a couple of times.
So you got requests that you take.
Yeah, well, my patients know that I, like, have a little weird musical, you know, side. Mm-hmm. So they're like, will you sing? I'm like, sure.
All right. Well, tell you what. We have a Cardi B beat we're going to play.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and start it up, Pete. He's going to get it going. I know it takes a little bit. So, Dr. Wendy, here you are.
All right. So they call me Dr. Cardi MD. They don't call me that, actually. They don't call me that at all.
Okay.
But today,
the
that's
day
what
they
gonna
do.
So here we go. You ready?
Yep.
Sister should press. Fill up and down, round and throughout her whole breast. Why that she won't check? If she check, we can catch and treat early, prevent. Put blood to the test. Ask and see how granny passed. She may know, she may not. Let's talk about it. I know it's a lot. I pull out my phone and take notes what you drop. Jeans when you born, might try to plot. Get up in her business, secrets must stop. Grandpapa thinks he's exempt, but he's not. His colon health matters, put polyps on watch. Sisters be flexing, we think that we hot. But pull up that push up and check for a knot. Check on them regular, keep them on lock. Just go round, round in a circle with stops. Recognize change and then go see your doc. She sent you to take a test, check them both out.
Yeah.
Say if you wait for the symptoms to stop, just don't wait too long. Treat that lump like it's hot. Press, 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 press. Won't she check both her breasts? Assess your risk, put concerns to rest. Call in, schedule your test. Please tell me you won't forget. Mammal screens vital to your health. Bra up, check you, sis. Bra up, check you, sis.
Yes.
Yeah. Just a little something I put together.
Is awesome. How long did that take you? Or is it, you got a free flow for a little while and then you're like,
you
I gotta write this down.
Yeah. I usually, whatever song I pick and choose and say I'm going after this one, I listen to it. And then I just start to think, like, what could I put in that cadence? Because I do take the cadence. I don't just take the, you know,
right.
beat.
No, you
but
do it
I'm
all.
But then I'm like, what can I sneak in there? And I'm like, and it usually comes together. It's like a puzzle.
Yeah.
It's like putting together a puzzle. How can I fit in a message in this framework?
I feel like you're just opening up your old biology and science books and finding words that rhyme, because there's got to be some unusual. Those are not the easiest words to find rhymes for.
But somehow it works.
It just flows. Okay, we got a couple more minutes, so let's remind people again. So it's Breast Cancer Awareness
yes.
Month. So I guess, I don't want to say step one, because everyone's case is different or they've never checked, but I guess for everyone out there listening, men
yes.
and women,
yes.
but especially women, what are you advising here over the next couple weeks?
So once a month, we should be feeling our breasts mm-hmm. up and down or in a circular manner, and even up to the armpit, because the breast tissue goes up there, a little tail of
okay.
it goes up there. The idea is breast self-awareness.
How long should it take? Because, like, here's the thing. They always say brush your teeth for 2 minutes.
I know, right?
You
do
go
we do
too
that?
Fat.
I do it. I do
yeah,
it.
I try to. I have one of the Sonicare
me
ones.
Me too. It goes
it times
off.
It out.
I know,
yeah.
me too. That's the only reason
that's
that I do
only
it.
The only way.
I'm like, oh, I must be done.
Mm-hmm.
I would think you could probably get through the entire breast in less than a minute, quite
okay.
honestly.
But
yeah,
give it time. I mean, make
yeah,
sure you're looking.
Yeah, feel around. Thrill, the three fingers, you know, the pads of your fingers, and really doing that circular or up and down motion just to really feel everything and know what's normal. People are always intimidated. What's abnormal? What's in there? What's normal? What's your body? What does your body feel like? And if you felt a little pebble in there, you'd know it was mm-hmm. up. Something was up. So do that. That's men and women once a month. For women, it's ideally after your cycle, because before the menstrual cycle, the period, the breast can be a little bit more tender,
okay.
a little bit more lumpy bumpy. But if you don't have cycles, or again, if it's a man, just do it once a month and try to be consistent with the time of the month. And if you find something, maybe give it a few days, maybe up to a week, because again, sometimes just hormonal changes
so
can happen.
So you're like the littlest thing, you're not calling 911.
You don't have to call 911. And really, really the littlest thing, even though we say early detection, that change is not going to, like, going from early detection to it being too late is not going to happen in a week or even 2 weeks or even a month.
That should actually, I don't want to say reassure people because you don't want to give them a false sense.
Sure.
But if they feel a little something, it's not time necessarily to panic. It should never be time to panic. But
But maybe throw it in your calendar and say, check it again in a week.
On your phone. We got the calendar reminders.
We have calendars everywhere.
Okay.
Is it still there? If it is, call your doc and try to get in within that next week and see if they can check it out and send you for some testing. Majority of the cases, especially if you're a younger person and you're not like, alcohol use is something that also increases your risk. But especially if you're not somebody who's a significant increased risk, I would think that, you know, it's probably not likely a cancer. That doesn't mean don't check it out.
Right.
I'm one who checks everything out, especially if it's something that's new, because I don't know. You never know. But just for a person's peace of mind, remind yourself it's probably not, but it could be. So let's check it out.
A lot of people, I mean, I admit, I've taken 2 physicals in the last 5 years. I know that's not good. Every
year
I should be doing
it. That's
better than some. Yeah, no, but I need to be doing it more. But I've moved a couple times in the city, so I have different doctors.
Sure.
I think I've got one I like now. But there's a lot of listeners out there that I bet don't have a doctor.
Yeah.
How do you find a good OBGYN?
You know, I Googled myself the other day, and it was hard to find out, because I even Googled, like, best OB-GYN, and people, you know, search engine optimization will tell you anybody's a great OBGYN. But I think that if you have friends who can refer you, or even if you just can say, like, okay, this is my area, let me go and have a meet and greet. I've had patients who come to just meet me before I became their established doctor.
Well, it's a very personal thing.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that. Now, it's usually a billable visit. It's, you know, just a low-level bill, low-level, you know.
You're like, you're looking at your watch. You're
making an appointment, ma'am, but at the same time, you can still find out somebody who meshes with you without feeling like you're, like, jumping full in, you know?
Mm-hmm. And so make that appointment. Get those mammograms, obviously, at the age of over 40, or depending on the case.
Or younger if you have a family history or if you feel something that feels abnormal.
Right. And if you are in trouble or you're underinsured or uninsured, there's other organizations out there, I'm sure, but a Silver Lining Foundation is right at the top of my head. Are you taking new patients? I want to give you a chance to shout it out.
Absolutely.
She didn't ask me to say this, but
no,
I will give you a plug.
I am. I appreciate that. If you go to loopobgyn.com, loop, loopobgyn.com, you will find me. You'll find my partners. We're really happy and accessible. And if you want to follow me on social, I'm at dreverywoman.com or on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, all my videos. So this was just a snippet of one of my videos. I got a lot more out there. If you go to YouTube, you'll see them all. It's like a whole rabbit hole, though, so be careful.
Be careful which way you go.
Just be there.
And I like that you're downtown, because, I mean, a lot of our listeners in the suburbs, but maybe they work down in the city.
Yeah.
That's a great way.
We're right off the L stop.
Yeah, oh, perfect.
We're right off an L.
Dr. Winnie, it was so great to chat with you twice today. We'll do it again soon, okay?
Oh, I'm so excited. Thank you.
Plenty more coming up on Extension 720. Turned off my own mic on Extension 720 on WGN.
Let's go, 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 White Sox. Chicago's proud of you.
Go, go, White Sox. And we're proud of the White Sox as well. They only lost, and I don't mean this sarcastically, they lost 89 games. They kept under the 90-game loss thing. They got a lot of great things moving forward. And they've got a great past, too, of course, world champions in 2005 and 1917, the pennant winners in 1959. But boy, oh boy, that 1919 World Series 100 years ago, certainly still something that is talked about, though a lot of myths have formed over the years about the Black Sox scandal back in 1919. Here to break it all down for us is Jacob Pomeranke. And Jacob, thanks for coming on WGN with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we're on, obviously, here. We are the carrier of the White Sox baseball. That's why I gave that really long preface to that about how much we love our White Sox. Before we talk about this scandal, and first of all, give us a little bit of your background, Jacob.
Sure. Well, I am the Black Sox Scandal Research Committee Chair for SABRE, which is the Society for American Baseball Research. And we've spent all year kind of shedding some new light on what we call baseball's darkest hour with the 1919 World Series. The 100th anniversary has shined a bright spotlight on the Black Sox scandal, and we're continuing to learn a lot more about this whole story a century later.
Is it a scandal that, I mean, obviously you're a big baseball guy, you'd probably heard of, you've probably seen Eight Men Out, Field of Dreams. Was that the basis as what you knew before you really started to dive into this?
Yeah, you know, I think Eight Men Out is still the entry point for most people in learning about what happened with the Black Sox scandal. But, you know, that the book was written more than 50 years ago, and the movie came out more than 30 years ago. And so we've learned a lot since then, and we've been able to piece together the puzzle in a little bit of a more complete way and come up with a better story, a more comprehensive, more accurate story than the one we all grew up with Eight Men Out.
My favorite part about this is that we're not rushed, and I don't mean to say that we have to fill time, but I love hearing the actual history of it. So take us back 100 years ago, and even before the World Series starts, set the stage for what this World Series was, the matchup, and what was going into the series.
Well, the Chicago White Sox were kind of a budding dynasty in the American League. They had just won the World Series in 1917, and World War One had ravaged baseball in the 1918 season, and a lot of players had to go off to war. And so 1919 was kind of this return to normalcy in America, and the White Sox expected to be very good, and they were very good, winning their second pennant in 3 years. And they had a lot of great hitters, all-around lineup with Shoeless Joe Jackson and Buck Weaver and Happy Felsch and a lot of great pitchers, Eddie Seacott and Lefty Williams and the Hall of Famer Red Faber. So they had a great, great team going into the 1919 season. And unfortunately, as they got into the World Series, we know now that a few of them conspired with gamblers to fix the World Series. And unfortunately, their legacy has been tainted a bit over the last 100 years because of what happened 100 years ago this month.
So they win the American League. And for people that don't remember, well, I don't imagine a lot of people remember, but the baseball at this point was, what, a certain amount of teams in the National American League. There were no playoffs that led into the World Series. The World Series was it for postseason play, right?
That's correct, yeah. You win your league and then finish in first place, and you go straight to the World Series back then.
All right, so on the National League side, one of the oldest franchises, in fact, the oldest franchise in baseball, the Cincinnati Reds. Tell us a little bit about them heading into the World Series.
Yeah, the Reds don't get a whole lot of attention because the Black Sox scandal has kind of overshadowed this very great team. The 1919 Reds actually had the highest winning percentage in franchise history, even better than any of the big red machine teams
in
the 1970s. So,
yeah.
So this was a terrific team. They had a very deep pitching staff. They had a 5-man rotation that was very solid top to bottom.
A 5-man rotation? What?
Yeah.
In 1919?
So the pitching staff was quite deep. And the World Series in 1919 was advanced to a best-of-nine World Series. The owners were trying to make a little bit more money and play a few extra games. And so they agreed to move the series from best of seven to best of nine. And this actually helped the Cincinnati Reds out quite a bit because they had a 5-man rotation that could go pretty deep into the World Series if they needed to.
So the White Sox lose the first two games. And the Tribune did a really cool project where they showed some of these articles and headlines from back 100 years ago as it kind of were where we are right now in this time of the season. And the first two games shocked a lot of people. And in fact, some people had already kind of, I don't know, publicly, I think it was the Cleveland Plain Dealer even wrote about some curiosities about what was happening.
Yeah, the White Sox losing the first two games was definitely a surprise to people, although they weren't as big of a favorite as the myths that have kind of grown up around this unstoppable White Sox dynasty. They were certainly a very good team, but the Reds were also a terrific team themselves. And so the Reds actually had a pretty good chance, even if the White Sox were playing their best.
Right. And
the Reds had a very good chance of trying to win this World Series.
And teams go down 2-0 all the time, even if they're heavily favored. So I guess, like, if you were watching it, unless you were watching every game, and of course back then people couldn't watch, I don't think radio was even around, or just very much in its infancy, if at all. So you had to rely on the box score to really tell what's happened. Do you think that's what's contributed a little bit to these myths, is the fact that we don't really have much video evidence or proof of the actual play-by-play of this sort of stuff?
I do think that does play a role. And until some of the film footage came out a few years ago, with some game action from game one and game three, unless you were sitting in the stands at the ballpark on those days, you could not, you know, go back and watch some of these controversial plays in the World Series. But there were some people inside baseball, especially some reporters and Christy Mathewson and Tris Speaker, two Hall of Famers who were reporting for newspapers about the World Series, who did have some suspicion about some of the plays.
They were able
to report during the World Series about these plays.
Because, look, a pitcher gets shelled out of character. That happens all the time in baseball. You know, a player gets four strikeouts one day, but they're a 350 hitter. These things happen in baseball. It's a marathon sort of sport. Individual games can be taken out of context, blown out out of context. So what was it? What little things did people notice or that were happening that would kind of allude to that the fix might be on?
Well, you know, you're right about not being able to tell sometimes when, you know, a batter does poorly or a pitch is grooved. It's almost impossible to tell because, you know, as we see in baseball, even just yesterday, you know, a player can make a huge error, a game-changing error, and that doesn't necessarily mean that he's throwing the game.
Right.
And so that could have been true with the 1919 White Sox as well. Even some of the poor plays, some of the errors they made in the field, and some of the bad hitting and clutch situations that they had, these absolutely could have been attributed to just, you know, bad playing and had nothing at all to do with the fix. There is some evidence that the White Sox called off the fix as early as game two, which was 100 years ago today. And they continued to try to play their best to try to double cross some of the gamblers who failed to pay them out with the bribe money. So we don't know for sure, you know, how many games were thrown or exactly how they were thrown. And looking at the box scores doesn't always find, you know, glean the right information that we can actually tell what was going on.
Games 1 and 2 in Cincinnati, game 2 100 years ago today. The series shifts back to Chicago, and Chicago wins. And by then, as you're saying, maybe they had, you know, reversed the fix or whatever it is, but a shutout win in game 3.
Yeah, that was pitched by Dickey Kerr, the rookie left-hander, and he wasn't someone that the White Sox were really counting on that season, especially in the World Series. But he came through and won two games against the Reds in the 1919 World Series, and he was pretty much a hero for the rest of his life for being able to win two games while some of his teammates were trying to intentionally lose them behind him.
That was Friday, October 3rd. The White Sox win Game 3. They come back the next day in the afternoon at Comiskey Park, which stood, of course, until 1991, I believe, and the Reds win 2-0. So you're down 3-1, but keep in mind it's a best of nine, so there's a little bit more wiggle room until Game 5 at Comiskey, the Reds win. So they're up 4-1, and at this point it seems like all hope is lost, but the White Sox rally back for a couple.
Yeah, and they really put a scare into the Reds by winning Game 6 and 7 and bringing it into the final game, Game 8. You know, if they had won that one, then they would have set up a winner-take-all Game 9 in the World Series. So, I mean, the White Sox certainly did have a chance as the series progressed to possibly come through and actually win it all, even though earlier in the series they had been trying to throw it. So
that's right.
It's very fascinating to think about what might have happened if they had kept winning.
Right. Game 8 goes to Cincinnati. They win 10-5. They kind of blow it out, getting four runs in the opening frame to win the 1919 World Series. Jacob, can you stay on the line? I want to dive into next, after the commercial break, what happens after the World Series and how we get to this infamous scandal, finding out about it, and the fallout from it here on Extension 720 WGN. Extension 720, John Hansen in for Justin Kaufman until 10 o'clock. Ken Smith comes in after that, takes you to 1 a.m. With Nick DiGilio. Okay, we're talking about the 1919 World Series, well known, of course, as the Black Sox scandal. We've got Jacob Pomeranke joining us. Jacob, research, what'd you say? You're leader of the research team behind this scandal specifically, right?
That's right, with SABRE, the Society for American Baseball Research.
I want to join the society. How do I get in on this?
Hey, all baseball fans can become members.
Hey.
I joined back when I was in high school. It's one of the best bargains in baseball. You get a lot of magazines and books that we publish, and it's a really great opportunity to meet some passionate and knowledgeable baseball fans.
That sounds awesome. All right, we're through the World Series. Now, the Reds have won 5-3. Some rumblings in the paper, perhaps, that the World Series have been thrown. When do we start getting some concrete, this wasn't what was supposed to happen?
Almost immediately after the 1919 World Series ended, Charlie, the White Sox owner and manager, Kit Gleason, had some pretty concrete evidence. There were some gamblers who actually came to Chicago and visited with the two White Sox officials and told them flat out, hey, your team just threw the World Series.
Oh, my gosh.
And Charles Comiskey actually hired a detective firm to go follow around his players who were suspected of throwing the series, and spent most of the 1919 offseason spying on his players, essentially. So
a little bit of a
George Steinbrenner move in that way.
Looking for their spending habits, where they were going, hanging out.
Yeah, just trying to find out more about what they knew, and if they had come into some extra money. And you can actually go read those detective reports at the Chicago History Museum today. It's one of the new sources of information that we now have available about the Black Sox scandal that wasn't available when Eight Men Out was published more than 50 years ago.
So he goes around and he immediately is searching for it, and then I imagine he finds some evidence.
He does. A little bit of hearsay, but a lot of evidence that the players knew a little bit more than they would say freely to the detectives. But the 1920 season was quickly approaching, and baseball was able to kind of sweep this whole scandal under the rug for almost an entire season. They played out the 1920 season, and it was only at the very, very end when a grand jury was called in Cook County to investigate gambling in baseball. And that's really where we finally found out for sure that the 1919 World Series had been fixed. But it took almost an entire baseball season before that happened.
Yeah, I could see kind of the dichotomy there, because I imagine Comiskey wants to know what happened. His team lost on purpose, or at least that's what he's trying to figure out, which, of course, is damaging to his team, his team's reputation, from a losing perspective. But baseball trying to protect probably the integrity of the league, because this wasn't a new thing, gambling in sports.
No, and you know, it's almost impossible to understand the Black Sox scandal without knowing just how intertwined baseball and betting were at this time. You know, you could go to Wrigley Field, you could go to Comiskey Park in 1919 and bet on, you know, just about anything that happened on the field. And that may be something you might be able to do in 2019 and beyond at Major League Baseball stadiums too. So, but yeah, this was kind of the culture of baseball at the time, and gambling was considered a very casual thing, and players associating with gamblers was a very casual thing. And so, you know, one of the things that we've learned about the Black Sox scandal is just, how easily baseball took this whole thing and tried not to really deal with it. They swept a lot of these scandals under the rug, and they had a lot of opportunities to clean up the game before the 1919 World Series, and they always chose to sweep it under the rug and try not to deal with it any more than they had to.
So the grand jury is convened towards the end of the 1920 season. How did the White Sox do in 1920, by the way? Do you know offhand? I can always look it up.
Yeah, they finished in second place. They were actually competing for the AL pennant throughout the entire season. They were kind of running neck and neck with the Cleveland Indians. And unfortunately, in the final series in September against the St. Louis Browns, that was when Shoeless Joe Jackson and Eddie Seacott decided to testify and confess their involvement to the grand jury.
Oh, while the season was still going on.
While the season was going on, that's right.
Oh, you thought the Cubs collapsed this year? Boy, that's a real collapse.
Yeah, and so the Black Sox players were suspended for the final three games of the 1920 season, and that's when Cleveland finally pulled ahead for good to win the pennant. But the White Sox were in it all along, and there's actually some evidence now that we have that the White Sox continued to throw games during the 1920 season as well.
Wow.
So this was not a situation that was isolated to just the 1919 World Series. This was something that the White Sox continued to do, and other teams had thrown games too. So this was definitely not an isolated incident, that's for sure.
All right, a criminal complaint, grand juries convene. What happens next?
And then in the summer of 1921, the Black Sox are finally brought to trial, along with about a half a dozen of the gamblers, but none of the big ones. Arnold Rothstein, the big bankroll back in New York City, Sport Sullivan, the big man from Boston, Abe Attell, the boxing champion. None of those guys were brought to trial. It was a lot of lesser figures from the Midwest, who were not as heavily involved in the scandal. And the criminal trial, one of the big myths that has grown up around the whole trial is this idea that the prosecution lost its case because the Black Sox players' confessions were stolen. And this was a dramatic scene in the Eight Men Out movie in which the prosecutors reveal that they don't have the confessions anymore. And it turns out that that's not true at all. There was a minor theft at the state's attorney's office. But the players' confessions were actually recreated by the court stenographer's notes, and they were read right back into the record. So this is one of the many, many myths that has grown up around the Black Sox. And eventually they were acquitted at trial, but Commissioner Landis, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, banned them for life from professional baseball the very next day. So even though they were acquitted in court, they were no longer allowed to play professional baseball again.
Why were they acquitted? Just simple.
Well, there's a lot of theories to that. Yeah. There's, you know, one of the leading theories that we have in our Sabre Research Committee is the idea of jury nullification. That the prosecution actually presented a pretty good case against, especially the three players who confessed. But the jury decided to just kind of overlook the evidence against all of the Black Sox and decided just to maybe send a message that they felt sympathetic to the players instead of the owner, Charles Comiskey, or the rest of the White Sox. And, you know, juries sometimes make decisions that are a little bit inexplicable. And unfortunately, we'll never be able to talk to the jurors themselves to find out exactly why they made that decision. But they did. And that's kind of how the, you know, one of the many reasons why this case has become such a complex and fascinating story is because there's a lot of contradictions to it in a lot of ways.
Let's go through a couple of the other myths here. So, okay, well, first they get banned from baseball, and that's sort of where everyone knows that story. And Shoeless Joe Jackson, of course, there's a lot of theories. What do we know? I mean, because Field of Dreams really plays it up like Shoeless Joe Jackson had no idea what was happening. I think if I'm remembering, this is just off my brain the last time I saw the movie, that I don't know if he was illiterate or he wasn't very educated in terms of reading, didn't understand the contract. What do we know that's true or false about the legend of Shoeless Joe Jackson?
Well, Shoeless Joe was illiterate. He did not have a lot of formal education, but he was a very, very smart man. He was a shrewd businessman who ran a lot of successful businesses with his wife, Katie, back in South Carolina, his hometown. And so he was a very shrewd man, and he wasn't kind of the poor country hick that he has often been portrayed as.
Right.
But you know, there are a lot of contradictions to the Shoeless Joe story. But the important thing to remember is he did accept the bribe money. There's no doubt whatsoever about that. Jackson himself admitted on multiple occasions that he did accept a $5,000 bribe. Now, everything after that about Shoeless Joe's story has been up for debate for the last 100 years and probably will be for the next 100 years. But we don't know, you know, did he play his best on the field? There's some conflicting evidence, and there's even some conflicting evidence about how involved he truly was with the scandal. But he did take the money. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. But everything else about his story is certainly up for debate and probably will be forever.
Well, right, because he performed so well in the World Series.
That's right. He set a World Series record. He tied a World Series record with 12 hits. He hit the World Series only home run. Those facts are famously repeated in
yes.
Field of Dreams and Eight Men Out and other places. So he did do pretty well on the field. There is some evidence that, you know, he was trying to play to win and that some of the other Black Sox players were trying to play to win on the field. And it's, you know, I find it very difficult to go back and look at the box scores and go back and look at the statistics to say exactly who was playing their best and who wasn't, because the reality is some of the Black Sox players performed much better than some of the clean White Sox players who were not on the take. So it's almost impossible to go back through the box scores and say, oh, this guy was throwing the World Series and this guy wasn't, because the reality is the ball players can, you know, perform well or perform poorly on any given day, and it's almost impossible to tell who's giving their best and who's distracted and you know, may not be at 100% that day.
Was Comiskey a Scrooge?
No, not at all. That's one of the biggest myths. And we published a project at Sabre called Eight Myths Out earlier this year,
yeah.
In which we took a look at some of the biggest misconceptions, and that was our number one, the idea that the White Sox threw this World Series because of how poorly paid they were and how badly treated they were by Charles Comiskey. And the reality is the 1919 White Sox actually had one of the highest payrolls in baseball. And so compared to other major league players, the White Sox were well paid, and that really didn't factor in too much to why they did this. But Charles Comiskey's reputation has taken quite a beating, and you know, he's no saint. There's certainly a lot that he has to blame as far as his role in this scandal. But paying his players worse than any other team in the league is certainly not one of them. And the evidence backs that up. We now have accurate salary information to show exactly what the White Sox were making.
Really just scratching the surface. You could dive even deeper into the box scores, all this sort of stuff. And you can do a lot of that at sabre.org. That's sabr.org. The Tribune did a great write-up as well, chicagotribune.com, as well as I love taking a look at the original documents, what the headlines read, what the stories read 100 years ago this week and into next. Jacob Pomeranke, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, the 1919 World Series on Extension 720 WGN. Extension 720 here on WGN, 9:35 on this Wednesday evening. John Hanson in for Justin Kaufman. He's on the morning show for the next few days, this morning as well. I'm with you till 10. Ken Smith takes over from there. Nick Giglio will take you to the morning at 1 o'clock, and then you know the rest. At least you should. I just noticed, man, how foggy, rainy, and dreary it is outside. I happened to be filling in last week, but I covered this topic really briefly, but I just wanted to remind you, it has that dark and stormy night feel to it, which, of course, is a trope for bad writing. The idea is a dark and stormy night. And I was curious the other night where that came from, and I actually dug a little bit, and by that I mean I plugged it into Wikipedia. And do you guys have any idea where a dark and stormy night, that phrase, comes from?
London.
I mean, yeah, you're not entirely wrong. You're definitely on the right path.
Sweet.
English literature in the past. Pete, any ideas? Any ideas specifically now? Its first known usage was by Washington Irving in his 1809 book, A History of New York. So actually, I think Irving an American writer or no? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he was. He was an American short story writer. So never mind. I teased you as you were right, Don. You were wrong. A History of New York. But it came into more popular usage in 1830. And this became known as a bad phrase of writing, which I think is unfortunate because I think it's really cool. So,
it's a good launching pad.
Yeah, right? So English novelist Edward Bulwer Lytton's 1830 novel called Paul Clifford starts like this. And I'm going to try and add a little effect to it, too.
Yeah.
It was a dark and stormy night. The rain fell in torrents, except at occasional intervals, when it was checked by a violent gust of wind which swept up the streets, for it is in London that our scene lies, rattling along the housetops and fiercely agitating the scanty flame of the lamps that struggled against the darkness. That seems cool. I like the way that's written.
It was good, just up until the end. Something about scanty flames.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Just at the very end there.
Right, threw a little scanty flame in there, yeah. But anyways, Writer's Digest described the sentence as the literary poster child for bad story starters. But American Book Review ranks it as number 22 on the best first lines of novels, so there seemed to be some debate about it. In 2008, the great-great-great-grandson of that writer of the 1830 story, so the great-great-grandson of Edward Bulwer Lytton, a scanty flame in and of himself, Henry Lytton Cobbold was his name. He participated in a debate, so they actually debated this in British Columbia. He debated with Scott Rice, who formed this fiction contest. Anyways, they talked back and forth about whether it was terrible, whether it was not. This guy who wrote this fiction contest accused this guy's great-great-great-grandfather of penning 27 novels who perverted turgidity, I intend to expose, denude, and genuinely make visible, which I think is a play on overwriting something. Anyways, he defended his ancestor, noting he had coined many other phrases widely used today, such as the pen is mightier than the sword, which we know, the great unwashed, which I don't know, and the almighty dollar. He coined that phrase as well and said it was rather unfair that Professor Rice decided to name the competition after him for entirely the wrong reasons. Give the guy a break.
Yeah. It was really harping on just one out of a group there.
And it's not his fault that It's a Dark and Stormy Night was so popular that it became overused.
Yeah, he didn't drag it through the mud.
Yes. No, not at all. He's the one that started it in a good way. It was made even more famous by the Peanuts comic strip. Snoopy, in his imagined persona as a world-famous author, would begin his novels with that phrase, "It was a dark and stormy night."
It's like getting mad at Shakespeare because you go to some community theater and see Macbeth just...
Yes.
Tank.
Right, exactly.
Like, oh, the bard is crap. Just garbage.
Like, come on. And the cartoonist Charles Schulz, obviously of Peanuts, made Snoopy use the phrase because it was a cliche. It had been one used for a very long time, but not insulting the work itself. A book by Schulz titled It Was a Dark and Stormy Night, Snoopy, and credit to Snoopy as the author, was published by folks in 1971. So it has definitely endured, but I always wonder where it came from. And I mentioned this, I think it was Friday night, I kind of gave a little brief history on the overnight. And God, I was just inspired by it because as we look out the window, boy, it certainly feels like that. Maybe not stormy to a certain extent, but certainly foggy and London town-like as we look out the windows here on the 18th floor. So there's a little bit of history for you. We're going to take a break in a bit, but I want to tell one quick story. Before, after that, though, Don and Pete and a caller, too, if you want to chime in and have some fun, 312-981-7200. I want to play a game of yay or nay. It's not trivia. I've got a few stories, and you just have to vote yay or nay. It's really simple if you want to have some fun.
I'm into that.
And join the conversation. But I was really moved by a story by Tom Hanks in an AARP magazine. I get it at my house, so yeah. I got the card and everything. I don't like subscribe, but they keep on sending me this stuff. So I opened it up and read this Tom Hanks thing in my AARP magazine. He's promoting A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
It was a dark and stormy night.
I read my AARP magazine with fright. So Tom Hanks, obviously, a very successful actor, but at one point, he was once so broke that he didn't have a winter coat. He also didn't know how to do his taxes. He struggled to make ends meet. In other words, it's the 20s, or not the 20s, my 20s, all of our 20s when you struggle to get through this stuff.
Right.
And he credits two lifelong friends for helping him carve a path to success. So he wrote about friendship in this first-person essay that appeared in the issue. Of course, you know, you talk about friendship and Mr. Rogers, all that stuff. And he notes how, as he depicted in the movie with this real-life friendship between Fred Rogers and a journalist, that genuine friendships enrich lives and help shape careers. At the start of his work as an actor, Hanks was performing at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival. Hey, Shakespeare! In Cleveland, where he met some fellow actors who helped him kind of navigate his early career. These two actors shared their joyful lives, Tom Hanks says, and professional passions with all of us in the company. When I was around them in the dressing room, in the wings, at the bar after the show, or taking in the Feast of the Assumption in Cleveland's Murray Hill, they were the professionals I admired, examples of the kind of actor I wanted to be, kind of human that I hope to become. And I think everyone, whatever line of business you're in, you have those people, I think, that you look up to and you admire. It certainly happens in our business here. It's amazing the people I get to work with here at WGN that you grow up listening to and you get to have and you look up to them. So he says after arriving in New York, these actors really came together and helped him along. One of them, McGann was his name, gave Hanks, who didn't have an apartment, his couch for weeks on end, a winter coat when he couldn't afford one. These actors taught him how to file taxes, all this sort of stuff. And it just goes to show you that, you know, we have all these friendships. Sometimes they're fleeting, they're passing, they're just circumstances of the times that we're in. But it's important, I think, to look back at those friendships, even if there's someone that's passed or if they're still there, to reach out, say thank you. I just wanted to fill some people with the positivity that I felt while I read the Tom Hanks thing. Because yeah. Imagine, Don, you've got someone in your career that's done the same thing or
Absolutely.
Similar things.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You can come stay on my couch if that's something you want to do. I'll
please.
Open it up.
Can you do my taxes, too?
I can't do so. Can you do mine, actually? Pete, how about you?
Let's do each
taxes?
Other's.
No? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, let's just all just pass them around in a
Perfect.
Circle. We're bound to get it right.
Yeah.
For me, it was a friend in high school, my buddy Andy Jakubowski, who lives in Minnesota now. But I was, believe it or not, I wasn't a shy kid, but I was certainly unaware of how uncool I was. I was in the marching band, the speech team, which is cool stuff, don't get me wrong.
I think that's also a fair thing. You could say that, because you just said, like, it's anyone in their 20s for Hanks's story.
Yes.
I think you could say at some point, like, all of us just unaware of what an uncool thing we were doing. Like,
yes.
I was a huge fan of Zuba shorts and, like, knee socks for, like, 6 years.
Uh-huh.
Unashamed about it.
Did anyone tell you otherwise? Or no?
Yeah.
Or, yeah,
like,
guided
mom,
you the...
every day, she was like, you can't go outside like that. But I would do it.
Oh, we're learning so much here. Yeah, and it was just Andy was like that because I was like shy amongst my peers. Like I wasn't shy when I do stage stuff or when I was doing radio speaking and speech team. But he was kind of that person that was like, no, man, you're cool. You're funny. Come hang out with my group of friends. And I don't think you find that in many 14 or 15 year olds, maybe now more than you used to, who actually was like, hey, you're funny. Come hang out with my group of friends and going out of his way to do it. And I think it actually really kind of changed the trajectory of my life.
Oh yeah, like sort of you know, Benny Rodriguez from Sandlot, you know.
Yes.
Grabbing Smalls out of his front porch and like, hey, come hang out with us.
That I've seen Sandlot so many times, I never would have thought that, but you're absolutely right. Someone who like actively sought out someone that seemed to be shy, and that was Andy to me. He was that person.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I had another buddy in college, and we're not that close anymore. Maybe I should reach out to him. But we were just walking around the quad, and there was a flyer for a comedy group, a sketch comedy group. And he's like, we should try out for it. And I would have never thought to do it, but since there was a buddy who was going to do it, we went and did it. Paul didn't make the group, unfortunately, but I did. And it really, again, these little things, these little, we talk about the butterfly effect and the flaps of the butterfly. I mean, it really kind of changes who you are when you have people kind of helping you out. So yeah, it's important to like make yourself this great person or to strive for the best. But I think it's important to recognize those important people along the way who did it for you or helped you out.
Yeah. You can never know at the moment or in the moment, like what the weight of someone's contribution is going to be.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, in that moment, you're not thinking, oh, wow, I'm going to make this comedy group. I'm going to do sketch comedy, learn to come out of my shell and improv, and that's going to lead to a semi-successful career doing fill-in radio and TV every now and then. Well, now every day, but you know, you never know which way your path is going to go.
Totally.
Wow, what a deep moment I've had here on the show.
It's dark and stormy nights. Yeah. I'll do that to you.
Dark and stormy night. Yay or nay after this on 720 WGN. Extension 720, John Hansen in for Justin Kaufman for just about another 10 minutes or so. Ken Smith will be joining us in just a little bit. He'll tell us what's coming up on his program. He's on at 10 o'clock. He takes us till 1 a.m. Nick DiGilio then until the morning. All right, so I'm going to try and play a yay or nay, just some hot topics that are in the news or topics that I've been reading about. Don and Pete, I want you to yay or nay. And the texters can too, or on the phones as well, 312-981-7200. You ready to play a little yay or nay?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is from fatherly.com, an argument about impeachment all you want. Just, you can argue about it all you want, just don't do it in front of your kids. It says it's fine to argue in front of your kids. In fact, it can be hugely beneficial for them just in general. Kids like to see their parents work things out. It gives them a roadmap to conflict resolution. But something like now, like politics or impeachment, if you do disagree, you should not argue in front of your children because it is harmful to them. Yay or nay? Argue in front of your kids about political things. Wait, Don, do you have any children by any chance?
No, not that I know of.
I love three non-parents making these arguments for parents here.
Yes, that's the
So thing. I'm going to say yay. Go ahead and do it. Teach them that the political world is different. It's a tough world out there. Yeah, go ahead and argue in front of your kids about impeachment. Pete?
Yay.
Yay. Don Kleppen, what do you think?
Nay. I'm picturing some endless and frustrated arguments here in front of those kids.
Yeah, so you're going to try and spare them from it?
Yeah, just for now anyway. Little bubble.
Not to put you on the spot, but Ken Smith just walked in here. How you doing, my friend?
I'm good. How are you?
I've never officially met you, and I'm excited to do so here today.
I'm excited as well. And have some fun.
Yeah. Do you want to play yay or nay with
us? I'll play absolutely.
Do you have any kids? I'm sorry. The listeners probably know.
Of course not.
Okay.
Yes. I'm absolutely not qualified to answer this question.
So go ahead and do it.
I say my parents would laugh if they were to not argue in front of me about anything. They would find this to be absolutely hysterical.
Right. And they'd go ahead and do it no matter what.
Absolutely.
Amen to that. Yes. Same here.
Yeah.
So we got three A's and a nay, right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so Bernie Sanders obviously has his heart procedure. That's a big topic, and it kind of raises the question. You know, we do have a minimum age to become president of 35. That's dictated in the Constitution. Should there be a maximum age for running for president of the United States? Yay or nay?
Nay.
Nay from Kleppen.
Nay.
Nay from Pete. Ken, what are you thinking?
Nay.
Nay.
The people will decide.
I'm on that same vibe. I think we're all kind of nodding our heads here.
Well, as we go forward and if we eliminate aging from, you know, the human lexicon, right. Now we're going to have, you know, 150-year-olds running against each other anyway.
I cannot wait to see that. I gotta go with nay as well. I think, like you're saying, like anyone can make that choice. I think health can be considered. I think
health should be considered. I'm shocked. I'm surprised. Because I said after Barack Obama was elected, I thought that we were done with the older presidential candidates.
Over 70 or something?
I thought we were done with those high 60, over 70s. Mm-hmm. I thought there was going to be people in their 50s from now on, maybe even 40s.
And then you get Clinton
and
Trump.
And then you get Clinton Trump, and mm-hmm. now you've got Elizabeth Warren, who's, I think she's close to 70.
I think so, yeah. In her 70s, I believe.
Yeah.
A Google search will help us out here. Let me give it a shot. But yeah, you got, obviously, Donald Trump is certainly up there, and then right. Joe Biden.
Joe Biden, Bernie. I mean, they're all of the front runners are advanced.
Yeah. Elizabeth Sanders. I just came up with an actress's name. What am I trying to type in?
Elizabeth Warren.
What yes. am I doing? Elizabeth Sanders.
Wait a minute. Colonel Sanders.
I can combine two names. I studied political science
she
in college. She's 70. Thank you, Don. Boy, not just in the nick of time, Don. Just in time for me to embarrass myself. All right, so four nays on that one. Okay, here's an interesting one. There's a sports reporter, Darren Rovell. Do you guys know him from ESPN?
Yes.
He did some stuff for CNN. Mm-hmm. So he was in Chicago. He was at a sushi restaurant, Arami. It's in the Westtown neighborhood, one of the best sushi places in town, according to some folks. And he posted a picture of his receipt, and it had all the sushi that he ate, and it came out to $84, his sales tax. And then it had a line called health insurance, $1.68. And that is an optional charge that some restaurants do that helps the restaurant pay for their employee's health insurance. So he opted to pay for it. It's on his bill, but then he kind of made a stink about it on Twitter. So he posted this thing and he said, "What's that about? Why am I paying for someone's health insurance? Why is that an option?" So should receipts, do you get weirded out? Yay or nay, should a receipt have an option to help pay for an employee's health insurance at a restaurant or something like that?
Nay, just keep it off the receipt. Just keep it short.
Just build it into the, just bake it into the costs?
Yeah, throw it in there on the total, but just don't you know, show that that's what it's, you know, being added to it.
All right, that's a nay, Pete.
Yeah, show it. Show what
you like it. You like seeing
what
you're
that. Paying for, yeah.
So that you can feel good when you do it, or I guess the Absolutely. Opposite when you say no.
Yep.
Would you do it or not? Would you pay it or not?
Depends on how much it was. $168 I can handle.
Yes, $1.68 on an $80 bill, so it's not that much. Ken, what are you thinking?
I say, well, the question was yay or nay.
To should it even be a thing that's on receipts? Like, is that something that the customer should be dealing
with? This is actually something I know a little bit about, because that whole movement started here in Chicago.
Okay.
And I say yay. It should be on the receipt. It is optional. Did you know that when you give a tip, it does not go to the back of the house.
Really?
It only goes to the front of the house. It does not go to the person.
Oh, I see what you're saying, to the chefs.
It doesn't go to the person washing the dishes. It doesn't go into...
Unless the front of house chooses to, like, give it to
the people. Yeah, they have a PO that they're doing.
So that kind of is a movement that started here in Chicago. It's optional. If it's optional, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
And isn't Twitter, that's what Twitter's for, right? Is to make a stink?
Yes. He is doing what you'd expect on Twitter.
Yes.
I just love a $94 bill, and you're like, oh, I can't believe it. You know,
with this $1.60?
Yeah, I just chill. Or don't pay it, and then don't have to tweet about it. Okay, UPS gets government approval for drone fleet. Packages delivered by drone. Yay or nay? Don?
Conflicted.
Yeah, right?
I say nay, because right now it feels like it's going to cause a whole heap of problems.
Okay, nay for a heap of problems. Pete?
Yay. Get me my package.
You need that bag of chips. The only thing I've ever ordered on Amazon, it's funny when I go in my history, I have a party every year where I just cook a bunch of tacos for people, and I've started doing tacos in a bag, so I've had to start mass ordering Fritos bags. That's the only thing I've ever ordered on Amazon. So anytime I go there, they're like, you want more Fritos bags? I'm like, no, I'm good. But in July, please remind me. Okay, I got a yay and a nay. Ken, what are you thinking? UPS coming by the drone.
15 years ago, I would have never imagined that I'd be watching movies and television on my phone,
mm-hmm.
but I can't imagine a bunch of drones buzzing around the city of Chicago
it's
dropping
different.
Off packages. So I'm going to say no.
Yeah. I'm going to say nay only because we can't even at the air and water show get people to stop flying their drones around. I can't imagine the havoc that it's going to create for the FAA. FA-nay, if you know what I'm saying.
Right.
Oh, that was bad. But, you know, it's towards the end of the show. Last one really quickly. All right. Cosmopolitan did an article. Oh, boy, you know I'm really stretching to the bottom here. Although they have some great articles. Anyways, why do men still insist on proposing in public, whether it's a sporting event, they make it a thing on the score? Board proposing in public, yay or nay? Don?
Yay.
You like it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a spectacle. It's supposed to be.
Oh.
It's not, and it's the pressure of, you know, it's the pressure of that threatening of shame, which is going to help you get that yes.
You like the extra pressure
for
the guaranteed, or at least almost guaranteed yes.
Yeah, back them into a corner there.
And then if they say no, we all got to see it.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, you're kind of changing my mind. Pete, what do you think? Public?
No.
Right?
No,
Ken?
No.
I loved your thought process on that, Don. It makes a lot. Just pressure her into marrying you because it's in public. But I say nay. I hate when they do it at the ball game and it's on the scoreboard or something like that. And then it's followed by another one. And then another
yes.
one.
Well, like, they kind of lose that special
feel. It loses it. And again, it's a more of a guy thing because the guy thinks it's cool. It's not,
that's true.
It's not, you know, unless the lady is a huge White Sox fan.
Right.
Huge White Sox fan.
Right.
Don't propose to her on the scoreboard at Sox Park.
Or if you met there, or maybe that was your first date or something.
Right.
Then I can kind of
see. But just don't do it to do it in public because it's a big thing.
Yeah. I was going to go nay, but I'm certain going on Don's train now, although it seems like you're wavering now, Don.
Well, I was only thinking, you are right in that it might get old because there's only like a window of what, like 3 or 4 months that would be pleasurable in Chicago to be outside proposing.
That's a fair
point. So you're going to see it all the time in those months.
That's a fair point. All right, Ken, you got about 15 seconds. What do you got coming up on the show here today?
You could propose by drone. Katie Darrell from the Top 10 Revealed on Access TV is going to talk about the top 10 British invasion bands and also mega hits from 1975. We're going to talk legal versus medical marijuana, and also the lead investigator in the Marnie Yang case is going to be here.